Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Give the gift of Boeing this holiday season. Take care of everyone on your shopping list with a Boeing gift card. Use it for skiing, lodging, spa treatments, retail purchases, Avalanche Bay water park passes, and more. Buy them online at BoeingCountrySports.com, any Boeing Country Sports location, or click on their logo above.
We got airplanes for shoes. We got 40 hours of daylight left. Nothing left to lose. We got highways. We got an entrance to the moon. God forbid you talk yourself into doing something that you never do. Something you never do.
To the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Man, it's lonely in here tonight. Jalene Jordan has the night off, so it's just me and Al Slayer and... just the two? Oh, no. Hey, it's you, too. You can join us. This is a phone-in talk show. So when we get rolling here, please call in at 313-298-WRIF. In fact, you can call in now if you want to raise certain subjects that have been, kind of plaguing your mind or making you happy or unhappy or whatever. Call up 313-298-WRIF. If you're bashful or the lines are crowded, can't get through, you can always email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And I want to say thanks so much. I got this nice, very short, but right to the point from the webmaster of radiopower.org. That's radiopower.org. From the webmaster, Shelby, I'm looking forward to your show tonight. You know you're like family to me. And I said, yeah. I said, it'll be 6 years this January with some form of the Peter Werby Show on radiopower.org. So thank you, Shelby, for all the work you do and for helping make this show and other progressive talk shows more available or available in venues that they wouldn't otherwise be. Really appreciate that. Okay, so elections, one in Venezuela, one in Russia. And one a few hours ago said Chavez wins Venezuela vote. Now, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez appeared to be headed for victory today, and it's for this referendum that would allow him to to remain in office as long as he kept getting voted in. Now, you remember, Chavez is wildly popular in terms of being a politician and has always won in free elections, and no one disputes that. Every once in a while you get this deal that says he's a dictator and all that. Well, you know, he has not done too many dictatorial things. Now remember, this is a Latin American country, and we are beginning to mirror those countries south of the border in so many different ways. Stolen elections and class struggle and what else? The disparity in income, great wealth, great poverty. So what would happen in Venezuela up until Chavez got into office in 1999 was there was a tell me if this sounds a little familiar. A conservative party, and then there'd be a liberal party, and then there'd be a conservative party. And people go, oh, those guys are too harsh, you know, they're just for the rich. We got to get the liberal party in because they support the common people and the labor unions and what have you. This is in Latin America. And in Venezuela, for instance, Colombia, places like that. Well, and then the liberals would be in, and they're not as bad as the conservatives, and they would give a little bit to the poor, and they'd give a little bit to the trade unions, but then something would happen, and people would vote the conservatives back, and this went on and on and on. So with Chavez coming to power and simultaneously riding this wave of great wealth for the country that was as a result of the rising oil prices, and his decision, like other presidents of Latin America before, and certainly in the Middle East, they decided, wait a minute now, we're not going to let all of this wealth go out of the country, that it's going to be state-owned. Most oil heads, the wells, are state-owned in the countries, the OPEC countries. And I mean, that's what the war in Iraq is a war for oil, and that's one of the things that they're trying to do, to declare that there could be the penetration of Iraq by these oil companies, particularly American oil companies, and not have them state owned as they were under Saddam Hussein. It's one of the reasons they didn't like them. I'm going to get too far afield. But a couple hours ago, it says Chavez wins Venezuela vote. Now it says Venezuela referendum too close to call. Now, there were 69 different little aspects. I shouldn't say little. Actually, many of these were major, that were constitutional changes. And now it appears it's a photo finish, which is interesting because Chavez is wildly popular among the majority of people in Venezuela. There is this opposition among the middle classes and certainly the business class, people that were, that sponsored this coup in 2002. What they say rings a little hollow, since they were willing to overthrow all the institutions of Venezuelan democracy and have this coup backed by Bush, of course. That's one of the reasons that Chavez dislikes Bush so badly. And yet, when they're not making him president for life. What they're saying is he can keep getting elected over and over and over again. But there is this great centralization of power, which I am always suspicious of. And I think people that have supported the programs of Chavez that that benefit the poor so greatly. You got to remember, nobody really did anything about them. And all these middle-class opponents of Chavez and all the wealthy opponents of Chavez and all the business-class opponents of Chavez, they never did squat for anybody else in the country, only except for themselves. So there was this enormous grinding poverty in, as you know, in third world countries or in most Latin American countries. And these folks, like I've been in Caracas, and you go in one district in the barrios, and it's frightening the conditions that people live under. They have hope now. And they have these, what they call these misiones, these missions, where they have doctors now, they have small businesses, they have schools, they're moving out of poverty. Great numbers of people are moving out of poverty. Whether this can all happen or not, I mean, whether poverty is too entrenched to even, be successful with someone who really wants to change things, I don't know. I think that's an open question. But Chavez is actually committed to that, just as he's committed to helping poor people around the hemisphere, including in the United States, where he's given so many Americans and other people in the hemisphere cut-rate deals on oil. Which is another reason, of course, that Bush and those folks despise him so much. Why are you giving people deals? You're helping the poor? Come on. But in any event, when you're in Caracas, for instance, you see, I mean, we would travel by these barrios, and the entrance about a foot from the road, and you'd see these places, these houses with no furniture in them, just dirty and run down. And then you travel, along in the city, and you go up to these districts where the people aren't Indios, and they're not Indian people, but they're all European people, and it looks like downtown Birmingham. So they were all real happy with the way things were. They lived just swell, and every once in a while, the rabble, the poor people would get out of control a little, and then they'd have to get, some liberals in there and do little bits. But Chavez is trying to do something major. Now, do we, as people that want democracy as a key element in any political system, want somebody who's essentially going to be president for life? I don't think that's a good idea. State oil, how would you put it? State oil ownership really lends itself towards corruption, just as it is in all the Middle East countries. And there's a lot of corruption in Caracas. I don't think it's a good idea to have anybody that can be president for life, even if he is elected. Well, I mean, it's a little better than declaring yourself president for life and then having, the cops and the army keep you in there. I mean, one of the things that Chavez has to do is keep getting elected, and he has, overwhelmingly. So one of the things that I thought was extraordinarily interesting in this, if you saw any of the demonstrations, they would have these big opposition demonstrations and these enormous turnouts for Chavez. And the fact that it says Chavez C, you know, Chavez yes, it's not what it should be all about. For one thing, you should have been able to vote on that. I mean, who the hell am I? I mean, this is typical American arrogance that I'm expressing, but no difference than, you know, what I suppose most people in the world have come to expect. Us, and in this case me, lecturing other people how they should run their country when our country ain't in real good shape and doesn't have a real democratic system other than formally. You know, formally it does, in a formal sense. But we know there's enough problems with that. And so if they would have had each, I mean, it would have been a big ballot, of these 69 different constitutional amendments, you could say, no, I want Chavez to have term limits. Okay, because it worries me when someone's going to get entrenched like that and you get this bureaucracy and patronage and nepotism and everything that it begins to look like some of the other countries in the Middle East where that are dependent on oil for the major source of revenue. But then, hey, can you hate the guy for this? Legislating a six-hour workday. I like that. I would vote C on that. You know, the business class wouldn't, but the common people. I mean, why did we ever get stuck with an eight-hour day? It used to be like a 14-hour day, then a 12-hour day, and then like in the 1880s, there was this huge eight-hour day movement, right? So the same class of people that are opposing Chavez now in Venezuela, in the United States, they said, wait a minute, what are we going to do? We got to start, get out the National Guard, get out the cops, you know, get out the Pinkerton detectives and shoot people down in the street because these people are radicals. They only want to work 8 hours a day. Well, somehow it got stuck at 8 hours a day. And you say, well, isn't that natural? I don't know. You could do it. It was 24 hours. I think it's a third of the day. Well, how about if we only worked a quarter of a day? And I mentioned this before, that during the 1950s, some of the UAW caucuses had a demand of 6 hours, or they said it differently. They said 30 hours work, 40 hours pay. Now, that they statutorily reduce the workday. You say, that's crazy. Well, yeah, that's what they said about the eight-hour day. The deal is, I mean, how much wealth accumulation, how much wealth generation and accumulation by the owners is there to offset that? Well, there's plenty. I mean, when you see the extent now that the wealth, how much accrued wealth there are, when you have, you know, multi-billionaires of personal a fortune. When you open up the New York Times and they're advertising, so you know there's more than one or two people, you know, $4,000 cowboy boots and $1,500 sport jackets. Hey, how about a $400 pair of sneakers? I want those. What the hell am I still buying cheapos at Dunham's? So, I think there's potentially problems with Chavez, you got to remember, these other folks have no solution whatsoever to the institutionalized poverty and the maldistribution of the wealth that's created by everybody in Venezuelan society. So what do I hope? I guess I don't hope one way or the other, because hope, some of these emotions, they're not much you can do anything with. But the opposition that comes out of this government, what do I always say? It's a racket. Posing as a government has a lot of nerve, as they say. Well, there's another election, too. This one was on Saturday. And Vladimir Putin's party, the United Russia Party, got two-thirds of the vote. Now, the United States on Sunday urged Russia to investigate claims of Election Day violations after partial results showed that Putin's party got 63%. White House spokesman Gordon Jandro said early reports from Russia include allegations of Election Day violations. We urge Russian authorities to investigate these claims. I mean, it just does not get any more nervy than this. How about if we investigate, what were the words here that they use? The Election Day violations in the 2000 election here and the 2004 elections. I mean, these were elections, in the opinion of many of us, for president, that were absolutely stolen. I mean, maybe if this is, I have no idea whether this was stolen or not. I mean, this was kind of gross if it was. You know, if it was, if Putin's party, you know, got like lost and they actually put in another third, that's pretty bad. Because all he had to do in Florida and in Ohio in 2000 and 2004 to steal the election for Bushko was a few percentage points here. Suppress some votes. I remember the people in charge of voting, Secretary of State in 2000 and 2004, were these Bush partisans in Florida in 2000. And in each case, it was to a large extent. I mean, it was voting machines to some extent that you can't, that aren't reliable, that, again, were run by Republicans. The machines themselves came out of Republican-dominated technology, voting technology companies. And then also the suppression of the African-American vote by a variety of different techniques. So, hey, you know, the pot calling the kettle black, in other words, here. And I would suspect that the vote in Venezuela, without knowing completely, will be much fairer there than it certainly was here. Well, because and it was like Mexico, where the conservatives stole the election. When was that election? 2005, 2006, as well. So, 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Actually, let me bring in one other thing, and you can comment on this if you want. I see some of you are already here and want to talk about a number of different things, so you can talk about those as well. Now, we're always talking about how happy are we or how unhappy are we or how, I mean, it's kind of a weird deal. But is this Gallup? Yeah, the Gallup poll. Republicans report much better mental health than others. So I guess I was wrong. I always say these people are a pack of twistoids and psychos and authoritarian nutballs and, you know, all this kind of abuse that I hate about Republicans, right? You know, sort of goes with the territory of being a talk show host. I'm not going to say some of my best friends are Republicans because none of my friends are Republicans, to tell you the truth. I don't think I'd have any that are. I mean, I'm friendly with Republicans, but I don't have any friends that are Republicans at all. But, I mean, with people, we've had this discussion, now probably not in a couple of years, but about people that are married to, like, Republicans. Oh, yeah, man, I would get divorced in a second. I remember someone saying, I thought you were tolerant. You're so intolerant. Well, I can tolerate them being that, but I can't tolerate living in the same house with someone that would espouse those kind of views. But anyway, here it is. Republicans report much better mental health than others. By the way, if you want to call in the meantime, 313-298-WRIF. Republicans are significantly more likely than Democrats or independents to rate their mental health as excellent. This is according to data from the last four November Gallup health and health care polls. 58% of Republicans report having excellent mental health compared with 43% of independents and only 38% of Democrats. And they made they took into account income, age, gender, church attendance, and education. Still came out like that. Almost only a third of Democrats reported excellent mental health. Democrats are slightly less likely to report excellent mental health than independents. The big distinction in these data are the differences between Republicans and everyone else. One could be quick to assume that these differences are based on underlying demographic and socioeconomic patterns. Oh, I love the way they talk like that. Related to party identification. But they reviewed mental health data generally and found that men, those with higher income, those with higher education levels, and whites are more likely than others to report excellent mental health. Some of these patterns describe characteristics of Republicans. Higher incomes, a higher education level, and white, right? Well, and men. So what's the operational word here, or the operative word? I would say report. Can you say self-delusion? Can you say, what's that river in Egypt? Denial, right? But anyway, I don't even know. Someone said to me, how would you rate your mental health? I don't know what the hell I would say. Would you say, is it bad? Okay, good, or excellent? I mean, I was talking, so I got a friend. I hope he's not listening. Every time you say, hey, how are you? He'll say, I'm okay. It's like you don't really believe them. And I have this way when people say to me, "How are you?" I always say, great, how are you?" And it occurred to me what I'm saying is, and sometimes I say that when things are going wrong. Sometimes I say that when I'm sick. But what I mean is, essentially, is I'm very glad to see the person that that's there. So if someone, do I have excellent mental health? I don't know. Yes, I do. I'm certainly don't have bad mental health. But it could be, again, like having to do the poorer you are, the less mental health or the more mental health problems you're going to have. And the other thing is, how about Democrats and independents being more honest, right? The fact that, how about this? Let me go on to this other thing. There's a website called armchairsubversive.org, armchairsubversive.org. So I would suspect if you asked all these people here that these are Republicans that were going to, how's your mental health? They would say, excellent, it's excellent. Well, here's what this is a list of. It says, stop Republican pedophilia. You know, everybody knows what pedophilia is now, right? There's not an unhealthy interest in children by adults. So, here, without going through where everyone is. Republican Party Chairman Donald Fleischman was charged with 2 counts of child enticement, 2 counts of contributing to the delinquency of a child, and a single charge of exposing himself to a child. Republican prosecutor John David Roy Atkinson was arrested for soliciting sex from a 5-year-old, then killed himself 3 weeks later. At the time of his arrest, Atchison was an assistant U.S. attorney appointed by Bush's attorney general. Republican city councilman John Bryan killed himself after police began investigating allegations he had molested 3 girls, including 2 of his adopted daughters. Republican legislator Ted Clount was charged with raping girls under the age of 16. Republican councilman Joseph Montalone Jr. was found guilty of fondling underage girls. Republican congressional aide Jeffrey Nielsen was arrested for having sex with a 14-year-old boy. Republican county commissioner Patrick Lee McGuire surrendered to police after allegedly molesting girls between the ages of 8 and 13. Can you believe that this is going to go on for quite a while? Can you believe that I have 8 pages of this? Republican legislative aide, now I'm on page 4. Republican preacher Stephen White, Republican talk show host John Matthews, Republican anti-gay activist Earl Butch Kimmerling was sentenced to 40 years in prison for molesting an 8-year-old girl. You know how that stuff is, right? Republican candidate Richard Gardner admitted to molesting his 2 daughters. Republican strategy, blah, 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 on and on and on and on and on. If you ask these guys, how is your mental health? They'd say, excellent. It's doing great. So I think mostly they're a pack of whack job sicko twistoids that ought to deal with their problems and not publicly. And not necessarily, by the way, talking about the average person that that votes Republican, although I can't understand that for the life of me either. But particularly these activists, they are really just a ton of sickos. All right. Here's Jeffrey in Lake Orion. Jeffrey, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. Thanks for joining me on Night Call.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
I'm good on the whole thing. I called you the last couple weekends and hung up on me and all that. But, hey, how do you think Hillary's going to be his president?
What have you been drinking?
I'm doing Budweiser.
How many?
I love you, man. I love the whole riff thing.
I love
it,
too.
I've had many Budweiser. But I'll hang up and shut up.
All right. What was the question?
How Hillary's going to work? We got you with Hillary.
No, I don't know. Hillary just dropped into second place with Obama taking the lead, and then the guy that God talks to directly. Now, we don't got to worry about him. Huh? God has put him in the lead, Huckabee. Is there going to be a President Huckabee? I don't think so. All right, thank you. Appreciate it. Lay off those Budweisers. Well, I do some Budweisers. All right, here's Rich in Ann Arbor. Rich, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Doing great. See?
Yeah, I've been listening, and I got an opinion on almost everything you've been talking about.
Go ahead.
I called about the driver's license for illegal aliens.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's right that U.S. citizens who have a couple unpaid tickets. They wind up getting warrants, and then they lose their license. They pay the tickets, and then cost them $2,000 to get their license reinstated through the state.
Yeah.
And then you're going to give illegal aliens.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to give them. No,
right.
No,
well,
one's doing
see,
it.
There's a good way of finding out if they're illegal anyway. You know what I mean? They get pulled over. They're illegal aliens. They get caught. They get sent back to where they came from.
Yeah, I never understood that this was this thing that was in New York that went down in flames, understandably. And I think like 75% of New Yorkers opposed it, so it didn't go anywhere. So it's not an issue. But how are illegal aliens going to go get tried? Hello, are you illegal or an illegal alien? I'm illegal. Could I have my driver's license, please? Yeah, I thought for a minute you were talking about space aliens, but no. So it's a problem solved. Thank you. Speaking of immigration, though, do I not make myself clear? I mean, I get the most stupid and mean-spirited emails from people who, and I'm sorry, I know this is someone who often listens, and so I'm not even going to say their last name. It's just in case you didn't see this one, Peter, I thought you might enjoy reading this. And it was this terrible, stupid, anti-immigrant piece. But worst of all, it was attributed to George Carlin. Now, I don't know what it is with George Carlin. Maybe that just that he is so cynical. I've played George Carlin stuff. I like Carlin a lot. But if you get stuff, promise me this. First off, promise me you'll never send me this stuff. Don't ever. Promise me that. Okay? And no jokes, no cartoons. Don't want any of that. I got too much to look at. But promise me you will never send out a George Carlin statement, because if you go, and now this is very important, so you don't look dumb to your friends and family when they find out that you've sent out an email fraud like this one about immigration that's attributed to George Carlin. Make sure that you go to Snopes, S-N-O-P-E-S, like Snopes with an S on. So Snopes.com. All you can do is put in Carlin, and there will be the thing that you thought was so humorous or so spot on and attributed, no less, to George Carlin. In fact, you would do well with a lot of this stuff that has to do with immigration and oil and all of that to check Snopes, which, and what they check is what's called urban legends, things that everybody believes but just completely aren't true. Well, you embarrass yourself by sending this stuff along, and you you fill people's email boxes, and it does not come anywhere near solving the problem. In fact, it could be that the problem of immigration is insolvable, given how things are, given that that we have Mexico operating at a level, an economic level that inspires people to come here to work. I mean, that thank you to for NAFTA. That's what did that. Okay, let's see. Should we? All right, we'll take one more call here, and then maybe get some business done and back to get you. There's some open line. 313-298-WR. I have a Jeff in Detroit. Jeff, hi, it's Peter.
Hey,
Night
Peter,
call.
How's it going?
It's going great, thanks.
Hey, Peter, since you know that most insane people think that they're perfectly sane,
yeah,
it stands to reason that Republicans who are totally insane would think that they are sane.
That's right.
And so quite naturally they would have a good report on their mental condition, but I'm like you. I can't understand how anybody that doesn't make at least $300,000 or more a year would vote Republican.
I know. Well, there's a whole question always, Jeff, that's been in my mind since I was old enough to think about these things. Why do so many people vote against or have opinions that erode their own best self-interest?
Well, you know,
what's up with that?
I got a theory on that. I may be wrong, but this is my theory. If you're more concerned about what your neighbor is getting than even yourself getting ahead, so as long as your neighbor doesn't get anything or somebody else doesn't get anything, you're perfectly content not to get anything too.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it, too, you've probably heard me use this phrase before, the politics of resentment. And the other thing is the politics of scapegoating. So you can scapegoat, you know, who's the scapegoat du jour? You know, is it African-Americans? Is it Hispanics? Is it immigrants? Is it Jews? Is it, you know, it's always someone when we, you reach a period where we've lost our way, where things aren't going well. Everything is going bad because of, you know, fill in the blank for the scapegoat du jour.
It's their fault.
Yeah, right.
You know, my marriage is terrible because the gays want to get married.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
All right.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having joined us. All right. We'll be right back to get all your calls. And if you're wondering what we're talking about, there was this Gallup poll where almost 60% of Republicans reported having excellent mental health, and only 38% of Democrats did. So what's up with that, right? I said could be a quality. That report, I said, was the operational word here. And also the Venezuelan vote, and talk about vote fraud. It's interesting. Nobody talks about vote fraud in Venezuela. Talk about vote fraud in the U.S. 313-298-WRIF. I'll be right back.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. And back without Jalene Jordan. She's off for the evening. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Call talkyes@yahoo.com for email. Now, a little earlier, I was giving this Gallup report, the Gallup poll report about that almost 60% of Republicans report having excellent mental health, only 38% of Democrats do. So are we talking about self-delusion and denial here on the part of Republicans or what? And one of the things that I mentioned was this website that is called Stop Republican Pedophilia, Republican Hypocrisy Revealed, and it's page after page after page of these arrests and prosecutions and what have you of these Republican officials that have been charged with, convicted with, etc., of attacks on children. Republican Congressman Dan Crane had sex with a female minor working as a congressional page. Republican activist and Christian coalition leader Beverly Russell admitted to an incestuous relationship with his stepdaughter. Republican Judge Ronald C. Klein pleaded guilty to possession of child pornography on his home computer, and on and on and on and on and on. So I think these people, I mean, there's a pattern here, folks, and I think they qualify as twistoids as a category, right? So what does that say about people that aren't the politicians, the activists, just the people that vote? Well, I mean, I don't. You tell me. 313-298-WRIF. Winston Smith writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Winston Smith, I can say the whole name because obviously it's the name of the protagonist in George Orwell's incredible book, 1984. He says, Peter, please post that list on your website. I want to post it on Randy Rhodes' forum. Well, Winston, it's already there. It's not down the memory hole, as happened in 1984. If you go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, B as in boy, E, peterwerby.com. It's over on the right side. What is it? I forgot what it says here about it. Oh, yeah. Parents. oh, no. Talk about it. I can't believe it. I left out the word not. It says, parents, let your kids join the Republicans. It doesn't say don't let your parents. Or I left out don't. This is, well, you know, there's a phrase called Freudian slip, right, where you actually say what you want. All right, maybe I'm a twistoid as well. And then it says, how sick are conservatives? Very sick. And so you can... You can see, oh, man. I mean, hey, listen, any number of you go to this website almost every day. At least that's what you tell me. So you've got to be, you know, one of the proofreaders. Or when links don't work, let me know, you know, stuff like that. All right. But anyways, the link is already there, Winston. Check it on out. Okay. All right. Let me, I want to get one more little email here. Delete that, huh? You know, this is what a this is dumbass. Okay, Kathy is listening in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and she writes into 313-298-WRIF. She says Republicans are delusional about everything else. Why not this, that they report better mental health than others? By the way, the blurb you read about Donald Fleischman, he's from here in Green Bay. I can't, you know, I read so many of these. Where? Oh yeah. Republican Party Chairman Donald Fleischman was charged with two counts of child enticement and all that. And it says the Brown County Republican Party disbanded. State Republicans have disbanded the Green Bay area's Republican Party after its chairman was arrested for child enticement and the party couldn't muster enough officers to pick a new leader. You got all these guys are going down. I love it. Oh, man. Can't we get some better than the Democrats to replace them, though? I guess we're stuck with them for a while. Anyway, one more thing about the twistoids. Remember Senator Wyde's stance? We haven't heard from him or from him in a while. Senator Craig, Larry Craig of Idaho. And now all these gay guys are coming forth to say that they had sexual encounters with Craig. This comes from the Idaho Statesman. You can go to idahostatesman.com. And there's an audio clip there, so if you really want some steamy stuff, go there because it contains explicit descriptions of sex not appropriate for children and listeners who find such content offensive. But here it just starts. David Phillips, Mike Jones, Greg Ruth, and Tom Russell. Four gay men willing to put their names in print whose allegations cannot be disproved have come forward since news of U.S. Senator Larry Craig's guilty plea. They say they had sex with Craig, or that he'd made a sexual advance, or that he had paid them unusual attention. He's the guy that said, I am not gay, and I have never been gay. I mean, you know, I don't like the sound of that, though, that their allegations cannot be disproved. I mean, that's not the way things go. I mean, but that's their little, I don't know, deal. So we'll move on. Lots of fun. Okay, let's, I'm sorry. Tim's been waiting a long time. Tim, thanks for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Pete, Donald Fleshman, okay, he was the chairman of the Republican Party nationwide?
No. He was, I got rid of it already, but he, where is it? No, he was like a county, Brown County, yeah, chair.
Okay. Well, regarding polls, I mean, you know, what I'd say about that is you have to look at the poll, I guess, itself and look at it case by case. But I think there was a poll years ago talking about, you know, how many people went to church.
Oh, yeah.
And so on. And I think you even talked about it on the air. I mean, they did. Somebody went out in some Kansas town and actually like kind of tried to match up the people who went to church versus the people that claimed.
Yeah.
And if you matched it up, I mean, the churches wouldn't be large enough to let the people in going to church.
Right.
So I think a lot of that maybe just be kind of be nice to the pollster or something.
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, maybe it could be that given the kind of fear and insecurity that's rampant in this country, I'm surprised, these Republicans, I mean, they say, oh, everything's fine. Yeah, it's great. Great. Everything's going good. Economy's good. You know, the war in Iraq is going good. You know, so they'd also say they've got a good state of mind. Well, I mean, they probably do have a good state of mind, at least on the surface. But, yeah, those polls, remember, in fact, I mentioned that before, when people always, it's hard to get honest answers about religion and sex and a lot of things. I mean, someone says to you things, I mean, even if it's anonymous, you know that there's a pollster there, and you're very frequently not going to give the answer that you think works best in terms of the person administering the poll, right?
Well, yeah, the one time I actually was polled, actually all the questions were about agriculture, which I know nothing about. So, I mean, nothing about sex, nothing about religion, and frankly, I don't know how I would have answered. I mean, those things are pretty private, actually, from the way I look at things.
But when they ask people about sex, mostly what they're doing is people are doing two things when they poll people. They're going to church and they're having sex, because people say, oh, yeah, I have sex three times a day, every day. That's right. And you go to church usually every day, maybe sometimes twice. So, yeah, but you're right. They found out that the whole church attendance thing was, as self-reported, was just nonsense. I was in a church. I had to go to this very moving memorial on Saturday, and I was looking at, and it's this huge church. I don't even want to say the name of it. This huge church, and they marked how many people were come, and like around Easter, there was 250 people there, and a normal time, there's like, on a Sunday, 45 people.
Sounds about right, yeah.
50 people, you know. And I'll bet you if they polled all the parishioners of that church, they'd say, oh, we go every Sunday. Bible school, and on Wednesdays, you know. Sunday school for the kids, prayer sessions for mom, all that, you know.
Have you been monitoring what the Democrats are doing in Congress lately? Well, now they have this recent bill. It's called 1955 in the House, and they passed 404 to 6. And it's effectively a thought crimes bill.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and these are the Democrats who supposedly were going to end the war, you know, and they were going to go after Bush for corruption, and they've been a complete disappointment as a party in Congress.
Well, they've been a disappointment. I mean, there are some standouts, like a lot of the work that Henry Waxman is doing in his committee to show expose so much of the corruption and lies and what have you, but it never goes anywhere. No, I mean, sure. So we go, yeah, they did that. Yeah. All right, Tim, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Yep. Thanks for having joined me. I always was going to say us. Jolene Jordan not here tonight. All right, here's Will in Windsor. Will, thanks for making our show international. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Peter. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the Venezuelan vote issue today.
Sure.
To me, that's just a total non-issue. I mean, all Chavez is really doing is asking these people to adopt a parliamentary democracy procedure of voting in Canada. Our last Prime Minister, Chrétien, served three full terms. Had he done a better job, he would have served a fourth. Tony Blair, same as in Britain, he served three. Had his numbers not gone in the dumpster, he would have served a fourth. Helmut Kohl in West Germany served for 12 years. I mean, it really, the United States is pretty well the exception because you have imposed term limits. But most parliamentary democracies and social democratic states in Europe are exactly the type of political system that Chavez is asking his people to endorse.
I hear you, but there is this larger-than-life personality that certainly wasn't present in those other cases. And it disturbs me a little. I mean, why should he, I mean, if there are constitutional prohibitions against it now, why should he want to alter it? Huh?
Well, I would argue he has every right to alter it as long as the people endorse it. I mean, all he's doing is putting forth a proposition, and they have the right to either turn it down or not turn it down. I mean, if you're asking me to speculate, I would say he's doing it because he wants more time to make sure that he can embed his socialist policies into the Venezuelan bloodstream before an opposition party could undo what he's trying to accomplish.
Well, That formulation worries me a little because there is a mass movement being built, and there is an extension of democracy in many ways into more popular democracy embedded in these constitutional changes. But the idea of the revolution being embodied in one strong man. So you don't even have, I mean, when you have thousands of people on the street with that's a Chavez C. That worries me. For one thing, he's talking about, he said he wanted to be in power in 2050.
But I guess what I'm saying is he's still putting it to the people to decide whether they want it or not. I mean,
I agree.
Yeah,
I mean, I do agree with you. And it's like, I don't know if you heard what I said in the opening part of the show, but the people that represent the opposition, and some of them, you know, they're like middle class and wealthy college students, weren't around, say, earlier, but the class of people that represent the opposition to Chavez, they never had a single solution. They never offered a single solution to the poverty of that country, the looting of it, looting of its wealth by foreign oil companies, and were content to have the social configurations that existed there because it benefited them. Now, suddenly, it looks like some of their power and what have you is being eroded, and nothing really has been done to them. Nobody's property is being confiscated. They're not being sent to camps or anything like that. When I was in Caracas, this one guy up in this wealthy area told me he cornered me outside of this restaurant where we had eaten, and he said, "We're like the Jews of Germany." And I said, "Really? Are they destroying your businesses? Are they, are they putting you in concentration camps?" No, but everyone's fearful. Well, nothing's happened to them, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's just exactly what they fear is the fact that you have the franchise extended to a large underclass, which are now utilizing it, and that's what scares them.
Well, also. For instance, the medical schools. Now the medical schools, they're drawn, but who can enter is drawn by lot, which means that everyone has access to it, including the poor. Before, this was the purview of the wealthy and the middle class. So it was this little, upper third of the country that benefited from the system. And they never had a peep out of these people. I mean, there was always people in Venezuela in the middle classes that advocated social justice and economic justice. But most of them were just content. I mean, people that think that, Chavez is this horrible guy ought to see this. What was this documentary called? The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which is kind of weird since it.
Is that the one where the Canadian camera crew was caught in the palace and when they tried to overthrow him in 2002?
It was an Irish BBC crew. But, yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary to see.
Yeah, I've seen it.
To see what fascists these people were. They seized the government and they said the Supreme Court is abolished. The Senate is abolished. And I'm going, wow, man. So now they're whining. And, again, nothing has really happened to them. But strong governments worry me. I have to tell you that, Will. They, it's the anarchist in me. And it's
no. I understand exactly what you're saying. You're always fearful of what he may do. But until he's actually done something, you got to give the guy the benefit of the doubt.
Listen. Actually, I was going to make an analogy that's really horrible, so I'm not going to do that. But what you want to have is institutional guarantees that that's not going to have. I mean, obviously, we have institutional guarantees in this country that have been shredded all along. I mean, beginning with a stolen election and other assaults on the formal U.S. Constitution. So it's not a complete guarantee. But, the fact that if, I mean, he could start getting the idea that I must be the leader of all the people, and he does seem to have that characteristic to him. Whereas what he should be doing exclusively is building institutionalized forms of democracy that put forth this economic and economic justice and political political freedom. So, all right, he hasn't done anything wrong yet. I agree. We'll see. Thank you, Will. Appreciate it. Thanks again for making the show international. Let's see. Here's Kate in Lincoln Park. Kate, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. It's Peter Werby here with you on Night Call. You too.
Yes. Actually, Chavez already has in the past done things that have upset the more wealthy people, including taking over a television station and promising the owners, managers proper reimbursement, which he has not followed through on. He has already taken over properties from wealthy landowners and created for the public good housing projects, which, yeah, it's nice for the poor people. However, he has not done it in a democratic fashion.
Well, you know, he can't do anything by fiat. There's laws that govern the state of Venezuela, and there's nothing. This thing about the television station, these television stations and newspaper, there is more the media, and I saw that when I was there and read it and watched it, that the Venezuelan media is the most virulent anti-government media of any country in the entire world. It has the ability on television to nonstop 24 hours a day denounce the government. All the major newspapers are against Chavez, and at the time of the coup, essentially what was happening with the United States connivance, it was like going to be like Chile in 1973, that the television stations cooperated in this coup, gave false information to the public, including this one that did not have its license renewed. You know, there's license renewal processes here in the United States as well, and WRIF, for instance, if this station, if it did certain things or didn't meet certain standards that we're really involved in making sure that we do, we lose our license. Yeah. Essentially what happened is that this television station that had been involved in overthrowing the democratically elected government of Venezuela was its license was not renewed.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, but what I'm trying to respond to that caller that said or is saying that it's basically over the ability of Chavez to remain president for life, that is only one side of the issue. And when you point out television stations being virulent against the government, is that not what you do?
Yeah, but there's
or
nothing.
Or should we shut you down?
No, of course not.
You know, right. So this is what a democracy is all about and what we need to support.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You have a right to say what you want.
But, you know, this only comes about when the left has an opening, when the left has a capacity, when the poor have a chance to start equalizing the equation. Prior to that, when everything is just run for the elite, when the poor suffer relentlessly, nothing's done, nothing's happened. Like I said, the newspapers are all in the pocket, just like they are here of the big corporations. But what I said was, I mean, I get this little teeny voice, and then there's a couple of small, progressive networks. But the vast overwhelming majority is either centrist corporatists with a corporatist agenda, or the big mouths of talk radio are these far right-wing guys that represent such a small sliver of the American population, yet they're in every city. They're in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cities. So you don't have this big overwhelming voice of anti-government sentiment here in this country, even though the majority of people, 75% of the people, don't support Bush, don't support the war, think the economy sucks, and what have you. I'm saying that every day you pick up El Nacional in Caracas, and it's denouncing Chavez as a dictator. Every time you turn on these TV stations, including this one, they're just repeating that the country's being sold out to the Cubans, and on and on and on. All right, I got to do something real quickly. Thank you. I'm sorry that we just don't have any more time in this segment to continue. Thanks for joining us, though.
They stayed in WRIF.com.
right, we're back. Usually we have a little bit of official production, as we call it, but I can do it. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. This is Peter Werby. I'm the host of Night Call, our public affairs program here on the Riff. And at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, which is in exactly 1 hour, I'm going to be interviewing Kevin Camps. He's the radioactive waste watchdog with Beyond Nuclear. And you go, well, this was an interesting, this was really an interesting interview that I recorded earlier, because E. E. Cummings, the American poet, said, "I don't want to startle you, but they mean to kill us all." So it's a little frightening what he's telling us. Also, Joel Covell, Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine, which would be nice to solve things there, talking about these meetings that are going on now in Annapolis. A little later, I think the next spot break, as we call it, you know, a little cluster of ads. If you've listened to Riff or some of the other stations in our group over the last week or so, you've heard me doing the commercial for the Gleaners Food Bank, asking people to help raise 500 tons of food for people in our area. And, you know, usually when we think about that, pardon me, we think about, you know, how good-hearted people are. Lots of you have barely been responding. In fact, I think we've gotten about 250 tons of food already. Here's an article from the November 3rd New York Times. It says, food banks around the country are reporting critical shortages that have forced them to ration supplies, distribute staples usually reserved for disaster relief, and in some instances, close. Catherine D'Amato, who's president and chief executive of the Greater Boston Food Bank, compared the situation to the recession of the late 70s. She said it's one of the most demanding years I've seen in 30 years. Now, talking about. Experts attributed the shortages to an unusual combination of factors, including rising demand, a sharp drop in federal supplies of excess farm products, and tighter inventory controls from supermarkets. But the key thing, of course, is rising demand. Rising demand. I mean, richest country in the world, we are. Everybody says we're the richest country in the world. And yet we have a crisis in food banks. We're worried about people facing hunger, that go to bed hungry. You know, people aren't starving to death in the United States, and they're not going to starve to death. That's not going to happen. But increasingly, people are dependent upon organizations like food banks. And it's not half of us. It's not a quarter of us. It's not a third of us. But there's millions of people, including lots of children, that either are hungry or at risk of hunger, up in the millions in the richest country in the world. So where's all our money going? Well, you know where it's all going. It's going, well, it's going kind of in opposite directions. One of it, of course, is going down this rat hole of war, this war for oil that Bushco has foisted upon us. And so, you know, it's kind of gone out of our consciousness because there's on one hand, the preponderance of military force in Baghdad, the pure exhaustion of the Iraqi people that have suffered so incredibly under Bush's illegal invasion and occupation, the destruction of the country, the millions of refugees, the horrible death and wounds that the Iraqi people have suffered, and there's still some, you know, talk about victory or success. Hey, by the way, there's some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. The national, where is this? The U.S. Conference of Mayors was in Detroit on Monday, last Monday. And this does not look good. According to the mayor's report prepared by the economic and financial analysis firm of Global Insight, the Detroit mayor. The Detroit region ranks seventh in the nation in terms of metro areas that have suffered the greatest loss of economic activity due to foreclosures. Now, people think things are pretty bad in Detroit, but there's six others that are worse shape than Detroit. Get that. The report pegs the value of lost goods and services here in Detroit at $3.2 billion. That's nothing. What is that? Is that, I forgot, is that a day? What are we spending? Is it? No, it's a week, isn't it? $2 billion a week? Yeah, I can't keep all these facts in my mind, but I know that everything that we're suffering doesn't have to be suffered. It's because of policies. It's because of decisions. It's because of these elites that are interested in how can they enlarge their already vast fortunes. It's the enormous wealth and power and prestige and everything. I was talking earlier about the $4,000 cowboy boots. They can't even figure how to get rid of all their money. By the way, if you're ringing, keep ringing. Al Slayer will be to you in a minute. 313-298-WRIF. This study also projects that Michigan will face a 75%. Why do I laugh? So I won't cry in public. It projects that Michigan will face a 75% decline in projected housing starts in 2008 versus 2005, and a loss of $124 million in tax revenue from lost property sales and real estate transfer taxes. The outlook is expected to worsen, the report said, as mortgages, both conventional and those with higher interest rates, given to applicants with spotty credit, readjust to higher interest rates. Well, you know that. There was two aspects of it. One is that this misappropriation of our money, the taxpayer money, that instead of enriching all of us who all are here as a extended community, as a nation state, it's used to enrich this small elite whose wealth grows and grows and grows at the expense of all the classes below them, which is 90% and 95% of the population. What is it? I think that it's these figures get bandied around a lot. But, what I'm going to say is, I don't have it in front of me, but this is generally what it is. The top 1% makes as much money as the bottom 50%. So what do we got? So that this class of several hundred thousand makes as much or more money than 150 million of us. And one of the things is the bottom 150 million people in terms of social power, social weight, political weight, and what have you, they have like zero, right? I'm sorry to tell you that. If you're making 35 grand a year, you can vote. That's not totally without power. But the command decisions are being made by this small elite that controls so much wealth. And this, there's an article. Let me see, I'm dropping everything here. There's an article in November 25th, in the New York Times Sunday Business section, which says, Payload, Taking Aim at Corporate Bribery. And it's interesting. It's very long, but this is how business is done. That last month, five jumbo jets from Riyadh touched down at Heathrow Airport in London. They brought with them 13 members of the Saudi royal family, including King Abdullah and his retainers, and controversy. Over the last 4 years, the British government has been dogged by criticism of its relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is Britain's biggest trading partner. The revelation that British investigators had discovered that this company, BAE, deposited $2 billion in payments into Prince Bandar's Washington, D.C. bank account led the Justice Department to enter what analysis described as the highest profile case of this kind to date. So without going into all the details of it, this is business as usual. This is all, this BAE is this weapons manufacturer, and this is what we mean when we talk about the military industrial complex. This is where our money goes. The only way that money is generated is through our work, and they got to pay for all the stuff, and then they got to pay us, and the rest is profit. So the more they can drive our wages down or go places where people don't get living wages at all to other countries, the more they got for themselves. Also in this country, they have a tax structure that increasingly benefits those at the top, so that the rate of taxation has dropped tremendously for the ultra-wealthy and virtually not at all for you and me. So it's essentially an enormous racket, and we are being fleeced. And that's what we were talking about earlier when we say, how can these people vote for the main exponents of this, the Republican Party, who saw to it that in the midst of expenditure for war, that more tax breaks would be given to the ultra wealthy. This is sick, folks. And it's going to come crashing in on us. I mean, there's stuff here. I can't tell you that this is going to be true, but a financial crisis will likely send the U.S. dollar into a free fall as much as 90% and gold soaring to $2,000 an ounce, according to Trends Research Institute Director Gerald Salenti. He's got a book called Panic of 2008. He says everything's going to go to hell. I guess I tend to doubt it. But that's what we're looking at. And we don't have to look at it at all. It's like having a compulsive gambler for a father. I don't know how many of you ever have. I haven't. But I know people that have. Someone, a parent who's an alcoholic and has all these compulsions, like substance abuse, and particularly drinking, gambles, and all that. So no matter how much money he makes, or sometimes other people in the family make, particularly like the wife, he squanders it. He gambles it away, uses it for drugs. He goes boozing with his friends. That's what this racket, posing as a government, Bush Co., has done over the last 7 years. And do they actually have a plan? I mean, I know there are some of you who think this is intentional to bankrupt the country and destroy the military, but, I mean, why would they do that? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've read a lot about this, trying to get an idea. How could these people have such policies that are so destructive on the face of it, where everything that the ordinary person needs, and, let me just back that one up a little. I've said a couple of times, you go out to Royal Oak, you go out to even more expensive suburbs, Grosse Pointe or Birmingham or West Bloomfield, and things look pretty good. Things aren't bad in my life, I have to say, and someone says I rub it in when I say that. But I'm trying to give you an idea that everybody isn't suffering. There's great numbers of people that are, but probably the majority of people in this country, in fact, I know, the majority of people in this country aren't suffering. But I'll tell you what we are suffering, and we're being looted. Is, like, for instance, at the gas pump, with our fuel bills, and on like that. When we pay more and more, where does that money go? When we used to be able to fill up 10 years ago, when Clinton was president, we could fill up our tanks for $8 or $9, and now we're filling up our tanks for $40. Where's the other $31 going? And when you factor in $3.5 trillion we're going to have to spend for the most catastrophic foreign policy decision in American history, the Iraq War, an invasion and an illegal occupation, we're probably paying gasoline at $20 or $30 a gallon. I don't know. Let's bring it way down. Sometimes that was, again, someone could figure that. But it's more than, $3.19 a gallon. It's more than $3.19 a gallon. Because you have to factor in everything that's being done in order to maintain U.S. control of oil in the Middle East and the fear that maybe people will get a hold of it and use it for their own purposes. Okay, there are some solutions, like getting off oil, period. Ending, who said that? What radical commie said we got to end our addiction to oil? Anybody remember that? Who was it? Oh, yeah, George Bush. Hadn't done much about it, has he? All right, open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And let's see, here is Lon. Lon's up in Fenton. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, sir.
Hi.
Listening to the conversations about Venezuelan, term limitations and stuff like this, how do you feel about term limitations here in the United States? Because if I look at it, sometimes a policy doesn't roll, it takes time to get it going. Sometimes you got billions of dollars being spent changing policies constantly.
Right.
Because you got another president, and I figure, okay, keep the elections every 4 years, this and that, and he's got the same chance to win again, and see how his policies work out. Of course, if he's not doing anything, you get rid of him real quick. But, I mean, is there anything wrong with keeping a good guy in for a longer period of time?
Well, I hear you, and I think that's a question that's never been resolved. For one thing, you do have people that that become such experts at the particular type of law that they're they're dealing with in a committee, and then they're gone. On the other hand, because there's so much money involved in politics, that was it. They figured, well, God, they wouldn't have these guys in there forever that tend to get corrupt or they get too friendly with who they're trying to regulate.
Oh, of course. But, I mean, some policies you don't even get to see come into effect.
No, you're right.
And there's billions of dollars spent just to switch the policy. I mean, I couldn't believe that people can that are working it can even keep up with it, you know?
Yeah, no. Well,
they're still working two policies behind.
Yeah.
You know,
nobody that I've heard really objects to the fact that American presidents are limited to two terms, which was recent. And you know why that was put in? You got to remember historically, because of Franklin Delano
Roosevelt, yeah.
Who was elected four times?
Yes.
32, 36, 40, and 44. Yeah, right. Four terms, and it wasn't like he was acting like a dictator or anything like that. It was just this kind of fear on the part of the Republicans that that was going to occur. On the other hand, now what are we having? We're having Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton,
exactly.
Bush, Clinton. But, you know, they still got, you know, it's going to be Jeb versus Chelsea in like 2016 or something like that. All right, but I think you agree, I think you raise a good point. Thank you, Lon. Thanks for joining us. All right, let's see. Here is Jimmy. Jimmy is in St. Clair Shores. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Peter. Good to talk to you again. Did you read the recent article in Metro Times about Scott Ritter?
No, the guy who was the U.S. Marine and who was part of the U.N. Inspection team in Iraq. Now, what did he say?
Well, it's just a great article. Explained about how Americans be, you know, how they're apathetic, you know, as long as they're wrapped in a cocoon of things are okay, on a rope to prosperity, but, you know, it's not really there. But another question I had was, you just mentioned that we're the wealthiest country in the world, and I don't get that when we got this national debt, you know, of what, $8-10 trillion? We can't even pay the interest?
Well, that's kind of interesting. We always use that phrase off the top of our head that we're the wealthiest country in the world.
I don't get it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that's an interesting formulation, Jimmy. But, you know, a lot of times people judge you to a large extent by your assets. So I'm trying to figure this through. So even though you're running a large debt, huh?
And then
too big for my brain.
I don't mean the saying, whoever controls the media controls the mind.
Yeah.
I read an autobiography about Jim Morrison years ago, and it showed Morrison with a camera, and the caption was written underneath there. I don't know if he said that. Did you ever get to talk to Mr. Morrison?
Jim Morrison?
Yes, sir.
No.
Okay, that kind of would have been neat.
But I did talk to his...
Ray Manzarek.
Ray Manzarek, and also to... why is my brain... The drummer. What's his name? We're bad.
Yeah, we're... but...
I know a lot about the guy. For one thing, he has tinnitus, which is that ring in your ears, so he can't play the drums anymore. And also that he, you know, that a couple of years ago they had the Cadillac ad and they had Led Zeppelin music with it?
Yes, yes.
They wanted The Doors, Break On Through, which was the first song on the first album. And the drummer, which will, if I thought about it long enough, I don't even have to. Someone will.
Yeah, we know.
Okay, he nixed it, and I was interviewing him, and he said, "I said it was a lot of money." He said, "I've made a lot of money in my life, and the figure they offered us made my knees quake." So,
but being for you know materialistic,
yeah,
he said, I know they're you know from the '60s, and a band like that did protest the war, and again, where's the protests? You know, I'm 49 years old and. It's just, there's just so many oxymorons and just...
All sorts of morons around. But listen, Jimmy, there are things going on. Go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and go to the calendar. I mean, if you want meetings, if you want gatherings, if you want rallies, if you want demonstrations, they're happening. They're all there.
Okay.
All right, Jimmy. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Jeff and Taylor. Jeff, hi, it's Peter. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
I have a comment about Bush.
Sure.
I know why all the income is how it is because Bush is trying to get rid of the middle class. He wants to keep a upper class and a lower class.
Well, I don't know whether he wants it or not, but that's what he's going to wind up with.
And what's so funny is that the middle class spends more money than the upper class and the lower class combined in the one, and the middle class is what's keeping the country at float.
We are the big consumers. I mean, that's certain. All right, I'm going to let you fight with that phone a little. Thank you. Appreciate your comment. Thank you so much. 313-298-WRIF. Comments, we will take them. Hi, it's Mike in Carlton. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
How are you?
Doing good.
I grew up in a generation that protested Vietnam, and I cannot believe how quiet people are about Iraq and how Bush is bankrupting the country. And nobody's saying nothing.
Well, there is, and as I was saying to Jimmy, there are stuff going on, but it's certainly nothing like it was during the 1960s and 1970s. What I mean, everybody says it's because fill in the blank. What's your blank? Why do you think that people are so quiet about Iraq?
I think that the kids, the 20-year-olds are a bunch of smart alecks. You know, you just can't tell them nothing. And they're more, they think the world owes them something.
Mike?
I got three kids. I was married twice. I'm not stupid about kids. But,
Wait a minute. Mike, doesn't that sound a little familiar? Like, couldn't you imagine someone when you were, like, 18 or 20 saying that?
I lost three good friends in Nam, and I almost went, but I got hit on a motorcycle. That's the only reason I didn't go to Vietnam.
At 49?
No, I just turned 60, man.
Oh, you're 40. Jimmy was 40.
I was 21 in 1968 during the Tet Offensive. Yeah. I was going right to Nam.
Yeah, yeah.
But I got hit on a motorcycle, and it's the only thing kept me out of there. I guess the Lord works mysterious ways, you know.
I guess, yeah.
But I got three friends that did get killed over there, and two of them are screwed up. They never did come back right. One's carrying shrapnel on to this day. And I just can't believe how quiet we're being, because Clinton had us balanced. I'll give him that. He had the budget balanced. And just now we're in the trillions.
Yeah, it doesn't make a bit of sense that...
And nobody's saying nothing. I can't believe this.
Well,
they're so quiet.
Well, I wouldn't say no one's saying anything, but there should be a lot said. You're right. I mean, you got to remember, both Bush and Cheney were failed businessmen, particularly Bush. Bush really screwed up a lot of businesses.
Oh, my God.
So, and they were used, particularly Bush, just, you know, being a rich kid's son, you know, they were, they never had to worry about consequences, that someone would, no matter how much he screwed up. And Cheney made some bad decisions when he was, you know, the chair of Halliburton as well.
There's a rumor around that Bush, that Cheney's running the war, not Bush. Yeah.
You don't hear much about Cheney anymore. I think they've decided he's probably bad bad publicity. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Yeah, people are always knocking that about. In fact, all of a sudden, people are starting to call in. Is why aren't people protesting? Through what mechanism? I mean, I always wonder why people don't come out for demonstrations. For instance, a lot of people now. It's kind of if you're not used to being in them, if you're not having been in a protest demonstration, probably doesn't seem like the type of activity that you would be in if you haven't. Whereas if you've done it all your life, like I have, it seems pretty ordinary stuff. I mean, I want to speak publicly. I don't want to say, because here, I live in a block, right? There are a couple people sometimes have come out to demonstrations that live either on my block or around me, and people have all sorts of lawn signs, no war or troops home now and what have you. That's a good way to speak publicly. Get one of those signs that say troops home now. I've had it up. My street is a little busy. It's not like just a little backwoods side street. So I've got, you know, so a lot of people come by, and I've had signs on my lawn for 5 years. No one's ever messed with them. So, I mean, some people say, oh, I don't know, my neighbors will think I'm... Well, your neighbors agree with you. I mean, 75% of the American people want us the hell out of there and stop spending all this money there. So you can get these signs that say troops home now. And how do I tell you to get them? Again, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. Go down on the left, and there's something that says paraphernalia. You know, it's a little joke. Some of you will get that. And it'll tell you how to get these signs from... Or you can go to... Or just look in the Ferndale phone book for Peace Action Michigan. Peace Action Michigan. They get you some signs. But in any event, I don't want to be silenced. And, oh, I know what I'm saying. So I don't know how many people on my street actually agree, but they could be sitting there saying the same thing many of you are. How come nobody's saying anything? How come more people aren't protesting? Well, when you go out publicly, if you go to a public meeting, for instance, if you don't want to be out in the street with a sign, I don't know why you wouldn't. Actually, it's getting a little cold now, isn't it? But you're there with people who think like you, which is always heartening because you're sort of made to feel like an oddball if you're not going for the official program, because what's reinforced is, like on the nightly news and all that stuff, and not just Foxhole News, but all of them. This is not activity that is worthy of the average person. So you're just supposed to sit there and do nothing, say nothing, be quiescent. Well, at some point, particularly, I know there's a number of younger people listening. At some point, 20, 30, 40 years from now, someone's going to say, Dad or Mom, what did you guys do during the Iraq War to stop it? And when we were being run into this massive trillion-dollar debt, and he went, nothing. Well, and you can either watch history be made or you can be part of what makes history. That's pretty phenomenal. If you think about the signal events in American history, beginning with the American Revolution, the abolition of slavery, the beginnings of the Union Movement, the 1880s, the struggle for the 8-hour day, women's suffrage, the anti-war movement before World War I, all the Union movements of the 30s and on, and the civil rights movement of the 50s, those were all staffed by ordinary people just like you. And they made history. And those, when we think back about American history, those are the events that say, this is what made this country great. We didn't let it stay as it is. We didn't let the elites control things. We didn't let the conservatives have their way. Because remember, the conservatives were against every single moment of our history. I mean, they were against the American Revolution, right? They wanted slavery. They didn't want women to vote. They wanted every single war, no matter how awful it was and how much of a lie it was based on, like the Mexican War and the Spanish-American War, all those things like that. I mean, they were for segregation, even though, some of them were Democrats. They were against the women's movement. They were against the gay movement. They were against everything. What they wanted to conserve was their privilege and power and what have you. So, act against that, I would say. All right, we got time? Yeah, we got time for one more call before we go to spots to our commercials. So if you're on the line, stay on, please. All right, here is Ollie. Ollie's in Troy. Is it Ollie?
Yeah, how you doing, Pete?
Good, you're on the air.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to make a comment about the gentleman saying that, why aren't we protesting? And I just listened to everything he said. And, I'm 28 years old, and I used to be in the Navy. I got out. I served during the war and everything. And my whole thing is that we're outgunned as far as being able to speak out because there's so much media, there's so much technology that, we're constantly in fear, they're constantly CNN and Fox News and they're talking about terrorism and everything, and that people are getting so spoon-fed that we don't have a chance to speak out. Like, I strike up conversations with people all the time, and I'm telling them, hey, you should really look into this. There's more to this war than just Al-Qaeda and all this stuff. And they automatically, I'm labeled as a conspiracy theorist and all this stuff. And I'm Persian. I'm a Persian descent. I was born in America, but my parents are Persian. And as soon as I say something, I'm sticking up for my brethren, apparently.
Which aren't even your brethren, right?
Which, right. And I tell them, hey, I served in the military, I served my country, but, I don't believe in the war, And my father, who also doesn't believe in the war, he says that, I can't say anything at work. And I say, why not? He's like, well, because they're going to look at me that I'm just, I'm sticking up for them because I'm one of them. And even though my father's been here since the 60s and he's worked and he pays his taxes and, cuts the lawn and does everything, he still has that sense that people are going to look down on him because he's a brown person, much like probably during the civil rights movement in the 60s, the racism towards black people and all this stuff. And I just think that we're outgunned with all this technology. People just pick up a phone and they could, go on the internet and just look up a headline. Automatically, they think that they're well informed. And I talk to people and I'm saying, hey, I'm 28, but I read the newspaper. I read a book now and then. you should do the same. Well, they're like, well, I don't have enough time for that because I'm messing around with my iPhone or I'm messing around with, you know, Google looking up, you know, something completely irrelevant to anything that's going on in the world right now.
Well, I'll tell you, Ali, at every turn of American history, the best book to read for all this is People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, is that it was always the case. The mainstream media, which, of course, to most of our history was a newspaper, were always owned by the corporations, and they always denounced anybody who wanted change or opposed what the ruling class was doing, that they were denounced as radicals and communists and subversives and anti-American and what have you. And sometimes they were jailed and they were beaten. And, geez, in the case of labor unions, they're attacked by the National Guard and by cops and private guards. And you know, hundreds of people died just unionizing during the 1930s. And people were shot down in the streets demanding the 8-hour day in the 1880s. So we've got it pretty mild. All we're, you know, some compared to, you know, people tell me, oh, you know, somebody wrote me just recently. He wrote me an email just recently. I mean, you know, tonight. Said, you don't have a clue. That was it. You know, you don't have a clue. Well, that's a lot better than being charged by guardsmen with bayonets. So I think you got to – well, there's a couple of things. One thing, you never can tell when you're going to win, and usually on these big issues, we wind up winning because what the government is trying to sell us usually and what the conservatives are trying to support is usually based on lies. And unfortunately, it takes a while for it to come home. And so we got to keep at it. And in terms of things going on, I'm looking at my calendar page on my website, and they have anti-war vigils. And here is Ferndale, Wyandotte, Grosse Pointe, Troy, Rochester, Royal Oak, another in Rochester, Women in Black, varied locations all over the area, Roseville, and then individual events. So there's stuff happening. It's not like the 60s. It's not like the 70s. You were just, Ali, you were just in the military?
I got out a couple of years ago, yeah.
Yeah, so you were in during the period of the Iraq War?
Yes. I was never forward deployed, but I did serve. I was in the Navy. I was an airplane mechanic, but I did serve. You know, I did my part.
Well, you know, you indeed you did. And are you familiar? There's a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War. And
no. And I did not know that.
Okay, and anyone who served during the period of the Iraq War is eligible, and it's IVAW.org, IVAW.org. And during the Vietnam War, there were the Vietnam Veterans Against the War at that time who did unbelievable work in ending that terrible war, also based on a lie. Because they were the, you know, you could always out, you know, during the Vietnam War, a bunch of college students. Well, thousands and thousands of men who had actually fought in Indochina were protesting the war. And this IVAW, IVAW.org, they are, again, smaller, but still beginning. Thank you, Ali.
Yep, thanks.
Appreciate it. All right, we'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, and I think we've got our proper... Oh, listen to this guy right after... right after we go into these.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome to our final segment. Jalene Jordan off for the night. She'll be back next week. Let's see. Connor writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I couldn't sleep tonight, so I turned on WRIF, and your program came on, so I decided to listen in. Anyway, I'm emailing you to see what your view is on Republican candidate Ron Paul. I support him 100% right now, and he's the most middle-of-the-road candidate to me. Well, I'm glad to see that he's against the war, the only Republican that is and gives voice to it. A lot of his other policies really suck, though. P.S., I'm only 14, if it makes a difference. Well, there's not a lot of 14-year-olds that these days that are interested in politics. And I'm a strong Republican, he says, but for some reason, Connor says, I'm weirdly addicted to the show. Also, I love your term for Republicans, wackos. Okay, I'll let, if people want to hold forth on Ron Paul, please do. All right, let's take some more calls. People are interested because we were talking about why aren't people protesting the state of things? And protesting, what does that mean? Usually we think about protesting as being out in the streets, but there's lots of other ways to do it. Here's Dave in Novi. Dave, it's Peter. Thanks for joining me on WRIF.
Yeah, thank you, Peter.
Sure.
My thoughts on why folks may not be protesting the war in Iraq is, a few things. But I think that in the Vietnam War, we saw in the media a lot more carnage and horrifying images on a daily basis. I don't think the media was as controlled by the Defense Department and the establishment they are now, so it was an awful thing to see every night on the evening news, and I don't really see that now. I watch the evening news, and I'm not seeing images. I'm seeing all kinds of other stories, and I think maybe there was a mystique perhaps about jungle warfare versus what we have now with an urban warfare that maybe the suffering that the soldiers were going through just being there seemed a lot more difficult than what we're observing, in an urban warfare situation. And so I think that may be part of it, is it's just not looking ugly enough. And I think one of your callers had a really good point about people are just so busy right now here with goofing around with their iPods and their internet searches and just kind of materialistic pursuits, and I don't think we have enough deep thinkers that maybe we did in the past, but
well,
that's just my thought.
Part of it is, and I hope I'm not stealing anybody's thunder, but one of the things that people say, there's not a draft. And sure, I mean, boy, there's nothing like the idea that you're going to be sent over to a war that the majority of people oppose. This is Vietnam. To make you into a protester, but I think it was a lot more than that. People in general, not just youth, but people all throughout the society in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s thought, things aren't going right, and we ought to try to put them right, and the war was like the worst thing imaginable. But, you can ignore it. You can't ignore. Also, think about how many people were in Vietnam at one time. 500,000.
Right.
And, the casualties. Man, there was, I'm probably trying to think, some of these weeks in Vietnam, there was like 400 or 500 deaths.
Exactly. We're being nickeled and dimed right now.
Yeah.
It's not massive casualties like it was. It's 20 guys today and 40 the next day. And
well, it's not even anything like that. It's like, you know, two.
And, right. And the other thing, if I can just add, is I wonder if the fact that this entire war has been under one Republican president is part of the reason that the country is not united in its opposition, whereas in Vietnam you had the war took place over Democratic and Republican presidencies, right. And so it involved everybody's political views instead of how it is now.
Could be. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Ernest and Troy. Hi, it's Peter. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Peter. This
morning,
is Ernest. I'm a Baptist minister, and just one thing I want to touch base on the war is if anybody out there considered protesting by the way of prayer, I think the way of prayer is a very good way to protest without putting signs on your lawn if you don't want to get involved in the public. I've seen the results. I think that's a good way for everybody to try to get us out of there. I don't believe we belong there in the first place. But now that we're there, I also believe we have to get the job done. Otherwise, anybody that's lost their life during that war has lost their life for absolutely no reason if we pull out before we finish.
What's finish wind up?
Well, by finishing, let me say it, probably George Bush's idea of finishing by forcing them to start a democratic society, which, again, in my opinion, is never going to happen because there's been a war there from the beginning of time, and I believe that's a religious war over there more than it is a political war, and I just don't see how George Bush feels that he can push all of our values on the Middle East overnight when they've been at war for thousands of years.
Well, if that's true, how will you ever get to a point where all those lives haven't been wasted?
Well, I honestly feel all the lives have been wasted myself because we never should have been there in the first place.
Yeah.
But if you had lost a son or a daughter or a loved one in that war up at to this point in time, and then we pulled out of there, wouldn't you feel a little bit bad, almost as if one of your children died for no reason, like we didn't complete the mission?
Absolutely. But I don't know. I mean, how many more sons and few daughters and how many more Iraqis are we going to expand? I mean, what if it takes 10,000 American lives? You know that whole thing about that they've found out that there were all these suicides now and that some of the suicides, there's been as many, what was this thing, 15,000 more suicides, including in 2005 there were 6,000 vets committed suicide.
Yeah, well, I think we need to cut our casualties as soon as we can. I'd like to see us out of there. And you had also mentioned something about you feel most Republicans are for the war. And is that what you said? I think you made that comment, something similar to that a moment ago.
You know, I can't remember. I don't even think most Republicans are anymore.
Okay, well, you know, look up Mike Huckabee. Mike Huckabee is a Republican who is against the war. And the one quote that I remember most from Mike Huckabee from a speech he gave a few weeks ago that I really liked is he says, "I do not spell G-O-D, G-O-P.
Okay. Well, he did say, though, that his poll numbers are going up because of God. I mean,
there's no question God can lift up any man that he wants to be the president of the United States. I don't care how big his war chest is as far as money goes.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess that's up to our voting process.
There you go. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter. You have a great morning.
Yeah, you too. Appreciate your call. Yeah. Oh, this, I didn't even catch the name, but someone called in and said that she had a friend in Iraq and wanted to protest, and it went away. If you're still listening, call us back, okay? 313-298-WRIF. Here's Drew in Roseville. Hi, Drew. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, man? It's
going good.
Well, first off, I'd like to say I think a lot of it has to do, well, I'm 19 years old, first to say, and I think a lot of it has to do with kids nowadays look back and, like, the hippie generation and, like, where did they get? I mean, it's just kind of, like, depressing to see. I mean, I hate the fact that, like, my generation is apathetic towards this and nobody is really doing anything. And
well, I mean, what is it? I mean, think about, you really think that the transition that went on, say, between 1954 when the Supreme Court decision abolishing segregation and, say, 1975, that there weren't tremendous changes?
Well, I mean, yeah, but you still have a of racists in America, that's still a huge problem. We shouldn't be pushing our ideals onto other countries in the first place. We need to fix the problems we have here before we try to help anybody else.
Sure. That's absolutely true. And that lesson, I mean, I would agree with you, Drew, that that lesson apparently has not been learned. And now the people that, say, 30 years ago were your age and they're 49 or 50 or 55, a lot of times they're the decision makers, and how come they didn't learn the lesson, right?
It seems like they've given up.
Yeah, well, I don't know. You know, I just went to a reunion on Friday night up at Michigan State, where I'd gone to school, of this group which has resurrected itself, called Students for a Democratic Society. SDS was the largest student group at the time. And I'll tell you, there were people there, you know, that were older, like from their 70s, and then there were all these students that were 18, 19, 20 years old. And there wasn't thousands of them, but there certainly were enough that it was kind of heartening. So the things are beginning to percolate. I mean, you can push people. Most of us, what do we want to do? I mean, when I went to college, what did I want to do? I wanted to drink a lot of beer and go to football games and go out on dates and, you know, listen to rock and roll and what have you. And then all of a sudden I got swept up in events because I said, wait a minute, I just, you know, there's got to be a little bit more to my life than just enjoyment. You got to have enjoyment there too. You got to have, you know, have fun. But on the other hand, I thought that I owed something to the people that were directly being affected by these errant U.S. policies, just like I do now. I mean, I could live, you know, just fine, I guess. I mean, you know, without involving anything I do, and we could, you know, this could be a show about sports and rock and roll. But I think I've got an ethical obligation to use my voice, no matter where, to the best I can, whether it's on the radio or to my neighbors or in a protest demonstration, you know?
Yeah, another big thing is I see a lot of kids not caring about voting, and that makes me so angry when I hear somebody say they don't care about voting, because that's just taking away power from the people. And I just, the people need to learn that. They need to teach that more in school or something, because kids nowadays just aren't getting it enough. Kids nowadays are, I mean, it's just sad to see how America's declining.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Drew.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling in. 313-298-WRIF. I think we can sneak a few more people in. If you're on hold, stay there. If you want to try to get in, we can probably get you in. Here's Carl in Ferndale. Thanks for joining us, Carl. You're on the air.
Yeah, I have my own ideas of why people aren't coming out. And one reason why I know is because I work at the polls. Only about 20% of people show up. And I think in one word, it's apathy. Seeing how Bush grabbed both of the elections, one completely illegally, and then the second one, everybody was kind of scratching their head wondering what happened. And it made people, like, you know, even I just thought, you know, what's the point? Because here you thought that you had a real democratic process, and it seems to have been circumvented.
Yeah.
And so it's not that people are just lazy, because I see that people will gather around for, you know, Breast Cancer March or a lot of other activities, Greenpeace, Sierra Club. But when it comes to voting, like you said, people are just saying, what's the point? Because when it comes right down to it, you feel like they're just placating you. They're just saying, you know, so that the public doesn't revolt, we're going to make it, you know, give you the semblance of something good, and you really get nothing for it.
Well, that does occur, and many of us got that feeling with the election of the Democrats last year. We were expecting this real confrontation over the issue of the war, particularly. It didn't happen, and that's one of the reasons that Congress's ratings are so low in public opinion polls. But, how do you overcome apathy? Well, it's tough. I mean, it's sort of like a snowball. I mean, one minute nothing's
right.
Happening. One minute it's the 50s, and it's, you know, they always talk about Ozzie and Harriet and this image of these uptight, all-white, conservative family situation. And then suddenly, boom, everything's exploding. I don't know what it takes to make things explode.
You need a light. You need to have somebody show a light in the darkness. Probably when this administration is over and we get someone who's not a clone of what we've already had, I think people might give it a second go around. I think the other thing that really contributed to it was 9/11, because when people first started to question the war, not protest, but just question, they had their heads bitten off. It's like the McCarthy era. It's like, what are you, a pinko? You know, it's like you're not a patriot because you dare to say something against the war. And it's like, well, look, I'm just not understanding. You know, it's these people attacked us, but we're going over here. I'm just not getting it. That's all.
Yep.
And I think they kind of, after that, they kind of thought, you know, it's no longer really worth being politically active if this is going to happen.
I hear you. Let me get some more calls, Carl. We're almost at towards the end of the show. You're in Ferndale, 4:45 tomorrow, up on Woodward and 9 Mile Road. There'll be a anti-war vigil. Give a look. You can just go by and take a look. All right, thanks, Carl. Appreciate it. Okay, let me get you folks on the air. Here's Mike in Detroit. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hi there, Peter.
Hi.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for talking about this stuff on the air. You do a good job, and it's
thank you.
It's nice, although you always seem to take the critical side, but at least you're out there doing something.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about how bad the war has changed my opinion. I remember seeing Kennedy getting assassinated a long time ago, and I thought that was just a horrible thing to happen. You know, it was just, couldn't even watch it. And after what I've seen with the war and why it's happened, you know, Bush is just trying to make money or whatever. It's something about that. It's not for the better of the nation and the people. I've kind of reconsidered what assassination means, and I hope I'm not talking about something illegal, but, you know, sometimes you have to change something, and this is, I can at least understand why somebody would do that. Bush is doing things that are apprehensible and shouldn't be allowed.
Well, but what we need here, yeah, I don't know where you're going. I hope you're not going, you know, what something violent. But regardless, we have the capacity to mobilize and organize in a mass manner. And if we're not, well, then, you know, I got to tell you, we are we're missing the boat, and we deserve what we get. Even though there could be millions of us, I know there's millions of us that are active around the country. Pardon me. If we don't organize and mobilize tens of millions, that if we don't do what have been done in countries just in the last 5 years all over the world, well, maybe we're going to just have to suffer through the bushes of the planet. Here is Mark in Monroe. Mark, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Peter. In regards to the issue of apathy here in America, I in regards to, like, the caller, a couple callers ago, I had mentioned that prayer was the thing to do. Unfortunately, I think that's what has gotten us into this mess. Too many people are getting on their knees begging God to make the world a better place, and I think it's a waste of time. I'm pretty sure that God told George Bush to bomb Baghdad.
Yeah, you know? That's right. I think so.
Yeah, and you know, you see a lot of bumper stickers that say pray for peace. Well, here in Monroe, there's a few floating around that say pray for victory. And I just think it's you know, pathetic for people to be getting under the use, begging God to make the world a better place. It's a dead-end street.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you much. Have a good night.
You too. Appreciate your call. Let's see if we can get everybody in. Here's Dave in Windsor. Dave, we got about 30 seconds for you. Give me the headline.
The headline? I just wanted to talk about the issue with apathy. I'm a younger guy. I'm 23, and I'm from Canada, but I can kind of see the whole issue everyone's talking about. Nobody seems to be interested, especially around here, like with the youth and what's really going on with the current issues. And I think that really causes a problem for masses to, you know, get together and really try to make a difference, or at least understand what is going on, you know?
Well, I do. But one of the things that happens, been my experience, even in times when it appears as nothing is going on, the idea that you join together with like-minded thinkers is, that makes you feel a lot better. So you're not just out there by yourself. And generally, that around political protest movement, there's always a pretty rich culture of music, of art, of poetry. Poetry. Yeah, I mean, isn't that what they sing when they sing the rock songs? So I've generally found that it's not only an ethical imperative, which is the most important part of it, but also, I, as far as I'm concerned, best way to live. Here's David in Walled Lake. David, hi. Quickly for me, please.
Yeah, how you doing? I was just heard a gentleman talking about voting earlier, and I just wanted to comment on that. I'm 18. I just graduated high school, and I totally agree with it. They don't teach it enough in the high schools.
But is that right? I mean, you would think that, like, don't they have, like, civics classes anymore?
I mean, you'd be surprised, honestly. They have some of them, but they're considered blow-offs for the seniors. So, I mean, everybody takes them, but it's not really, like, anything intense. It's kind of different.
Yeah, I think there is, you know, either we're going to just watch as life passes us by, or we're going to be the forces that that actually make history. All right, thank you for being our last caller. I appreciate it. Stay tuned. I've got Kevin Camps talking about going to be more nukes. Mark called from Monroe. That's the home of Fermi 2, as well as General George Custer. So let you know what these folks have in mind for our little bio region here. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening. Jalene Jordan will be back with me next week.
This is WRIN.com.
Started shaking and I can't take no more.
Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. I was looking at the website beyondnuclear.org, beyondnuclear.org, and it said, join Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, Graham Nash, and others in stopping nuclear power. I'm thinking, what year is this? Didn't they do a big No Nukes concert in 1979? Isn't that almost a generation ago, 30 years? I guess so.
But deja vu all over again.
There we go. The voice we are hearing is Kevin Camps. He works with Beyond Nuclear. And his title, Radioactive Waste Watchdog. from Washington, D.C. It's a pleasure to welcome Kevin Camps. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Peter.
It's not a pleasure. And I should say here, let me look up here. It says you've traveled widely across the U.S. and overseas, speaking to many community and governmental forums. And before joining Beyond Nuclear, for 8 years, you were the radioactive waste specialist at the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Those are good folks as well who we've had on the Peter Werbe Show before. But so radioactive waste watchdog. Unfortunately, you're going to have to do some barking right here in the Great Lakes region. Tell us about that.
Oh, very much so. Radioactive waste issues are huge in the Great Lakes. I mean, the Palisades Nuclear Power Plant in southwest Michigan has high-level radioactive wastes parked on an unstable sand dune and very vulnerable to earthquake risks. And so the earthquake that hit Japan this past summer showed how dangerous nuclear power plants and earthquakes are when they mix. And unfortunately, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has let Palisades just get away with murder over there, parking these high-level wastes on a sand dune. And the same is true at all the nuclear plants in the Great Lakes Basin, and there are a lot. We've got them in Wisconsin. We've got them across Michigan. We've got them in Ontario. We've got them in northern Ohio. Altogether, there are scores of nuclear power plants throughout the Great Lakes, and they're all sitting on the high-level radioactive waste that they've ever generated in their history. So there's a lot of risk there.
Well, Kevin Camps, you said they're getting away with murder in many ways. The NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, that doesn't say C, does it? It's commission.
Commission,
yeah.
So we call it the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission.
It really, given the definitions of nuclear power and the waste that it generates, it really doesn't have much option other than to let them get away with murder, right? I mean, they've got this toxic waste that's they can be there for hundreds of thousands of years. There's not much they can do within their current parameters.
Well, you're getting right to the heart of it right away, and that is that we should not be generating this stuff in the first place. You know, nuclear power generates electricity as a fleeting byproduct, but the actual product is forever deadly radioactive waste. And it makes no sense to boil water this way to make electricity. There's much better options out there. Energy efficiency and renewables could easily do away with the need for nuclear power. So we're creating for ourselves and for the next 12,000 generations or more this unsolvable problem. And you're right, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is really, it's a rogue agency. It's a shill for the industry. Unfortunately, there are some things that could make the situation a bit less dangerous, but they don't even do that because they're always trying to save the industry money. We saw that very clearly at Davis-Bessie in Ohio.
Very close to us, and it would, and all these plants are always are troubled. And we thought the reason that I mentioned the 1979 concert, I think it was at Madison Square Garden with Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Brown, Graham Nash, and others, that this was a settled issue. That what wasn't settled was how do we decommission these plants that are online, and how do we deal if we can, which is a frightening concept. If we can, how do we deal with the waste that they've generated and safeguarded for how many generations?
Well, plutonium is deadly for 240,000 years, so that's about 12,000 human generations. But there's other stuff in the waste that's deadly for longer, so it's virtually forevermore.
It is, because Homo sapiens really arose like 50,000 years ago, right?
That's right. Yeah. This is unprecedented in human history.
Yeah. But what I thought was gone, but this is like Night of the Living Dead. Suddenly they're talking about commissioning new plants.
Well, you're right. You know, the Bush administration is probably the most pro-nuclear in U.S. history, which is really saying something, because Nixon envisioned 1,000 reactors in the United States by the year 2000, and he was shortly impeached thereafter, so I hope that history repeats itself, because Bush is really pushing nuclear power. They started in May of 2001. They'd been in office about 2 months when Cheney put out his secretive Energy Task Force report, and it was very pro-nuclear. And ever since, the industry has been touting its so-called renaissance, which we call a relapse. And the closest to home there is Fermi Nuclear Power Plant, where Detroit Edison wants to build a new reactor. And I should add that it's at taxpayer expense. That's the big issue right now, is that the U.S. government, the Bush administration, and pro-nuclear members of Congress want to pay for these new reactors with federal loan guarantees to the tune of $50 billion in the next 2 years alone.
Kevin Camps is my guest. He's from beyondnuclear.org. One of the arguments, and people have even been extrapolating this from Al Gore's material, that we can't keep burning fossil fuel just because of its polluting qualities, but also because it draws us into these conflicts in the Middle East. I mean, we're involved in a war for oil. We're expending, which could wind up to be $3.5 trillion just so we'll get some gasoline in our tank and keep our houses warm. Particularly for the latter and for industry and lighting our homes, all that, that nuclear power, hey, other than we don't want to talk about the nuclear waste, but it's a non-polluting generation of energy there. So is that partly what has made it put it back on the agenda?
Well, yeah, the nuclear power industry, even 10 years ago, was trying to present itself as a solution to the climate crisis. So they've been at work on that for a long time. The problem is it's not true. Nuclear does have significant carbon dioxide emissions because you've got the whole nuclear fuel chain from mining to milling to processing to conversion to enrichment of the uranium. And then they got to truck the fuel to the nuke plants. And then you've got to deal with the waste forevermore into the future. And every one of those stages in the nuclear fuel chain emits carbon dioxide. So it is accurate to say that nuclear is a so-called low emitter of carbon dioxide, unless you look at the forevermore waste management, and then it starts to inch up there. But the thing is, the high-grade uranium ore in the world is dissipating quickly. And as the ore grade dissipates, you're going to have to use more fossil fuels to extract and enrich the uranium. So eventually, maybe a century or less from now, you're going to have carbon emissions from nuclear power that are about the same as the carbon dioxide emissions from natural gas use for electricity. So it's really a bogus argument that they're presenting. And like you said, you got to look at the other side of nuclear power, too. You've got to look at the waste, the vulnerability to terrorist attack and catastrophic accident, and even the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Because if you're going to enrich enough uranium or reprocess enough waste to run these reactors, then you are risking nuclear weapons proliferation in a big way.
Hmm. Well, you were just one of several speakers at a binational forum that was held in Warren, Michigan on November 3rd called Dangers of Nuclear Power. Some of the people that I know that have been opposing Fermi 2 down in Monroe, Michigan, or as we say, the home of Fermi 2 and General George Custer, they came to the conference, and to be real honest with you, they were a little disappointed at the turnout because here it looks like we're facing this possibility of restarting nuclear or expanding nuclear generation here in the Great Lakes Basin, and it wasn't real well attended. It's not hot on everyone's agenda, is it?
Well, you know, it gets back to your original point about the No Nukes concert in 1979. It's fair to say that was probably the apex of the anti-nuclear power movement in the United States. Huge crowds turning out. I mean, at that concert, they got 100,000 people during the course of that week, and then they had an outdoor concert for free that brought in 200,000 people. So, you know, folks thought that we had, you know, fought the nuclear power industry to a standstill. I was 10 years old at the time. But I have to say, from 1980 right up into the present, there have been a core group of anti-nuclear activists, including folks like Michael Keegan at Coalition for Nuclear Free Great Lakes in Monroe, in the shadow of Fermi, who have continued to watchdog these facilities and, you know, expose the dangers that are ever present and going on all the time, the accidents and incidents, getting it out to the media. And those folks have been there, have been in the trenches battling. And our challenge now is to rebuild the anti-nuclear movement to its former glory, because there are 32 or more new reactors proposed in the United States. And DTE wants to build one at Fermi, most likely. It would be a French design from the company called Areva, which is headed by none other than Spence Abraham in North America, Bush's first energy secretary, who got that job when he lost his Senate race in Michigan. And he is the North American chairman of Areva. And this French company is the biggest nuclear company in the world. They build reactors. They also reprocess waste. And so one of the fears is that Detroit Edison, which was an early proponent of plutonium fuel economy and reprocessing of waste way back in the 1950s and early 60s with its Fermi 1 breeder reactor, The fear is that they may be dabbling in that kind of business again.
Right.
So we've had enough bad news from the Fermi 1 meltdown. We almost lost Detroit, not to do that over again.
Yeah, let's remind people there's a book called We Almost Lost Detroit by, remind me the author?
John Fuller.
John Fuller, indeed, yeah. This is the night of the living dead. Not only do we have suddenly the nuclear powers coming out of the grave, it's also the return of Spence Abraham. And we used to call that after the 2000 election, Bush's cabinet, the cabinet of the losers. Spence Abraham lost, as you indicated, Kevin Camps, the senatorial race here in Michigan. John Ashcroft lost to a dead man in Missouri, became... the head of the Justice Department, but that's another conversation. This is the Peter Werbe Show. Kevin Camps is my guest. He's from Beyond Nuclear. You can go to beyondnuclear.org. I shouldn't even say you can, and I hate to use words like this, but, you know, you really should. Things are going to be happening in our area unless we take some action that is going to affect not just us, but our kids and our kids. And I won't keep going down because, as Kevin said before, we're talking about generating waste that could be with us for 12,000 human generation. And Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog for beyondnuclear.org. Now, at this conference a month ago almost now in Warren, I was surprised to learn that the Canadian government is also interested in nuclear generation. I say that because we usually think, you know, Bush, oil man, bad, Canada, green. They're the green folks. What's their role in all this?
Oh, talk about getting away with murder. It's ironic. I mean, I grew up with that same stereotype about Canada. I'm from Kalamazoo, by the way, and I'm on Don't Waste Michigan's board from the Kalamazoo chapter. And, you know, I had that same stereotype, but I learned pretty quickly that there is a lot of nuclear activity, especially in Ontario. There are 22 nuclear reactors in Canada, and 20 of them are in Ontario. And all of those in Ontario are on the Great Lakes. So one of the biggest nuclear power plants in the world is the Bruce Nuclear Complex. It's on the Bruce Peninsula, and it's 50 miles across Lake Huron from Michigan.
Right.
And they are up to so much no good, it's hard to summarize. They've got the 8 reactors there. That's a lot of accident potential. They also have, in the works, one of the largest dry cask storage facilities for high-level radioactive waste on the planet. They want to have 2,000 containers of high-level radioactive waste parked on the lakeshore. And just compare that to Palisades, which is bad enough. They've got about 35 or so of these containers, so 2,000 versus 35. And the latest proposal at Bruce is they want to create a Yucca Mountain on the Lake Huron shoreline. They want to create a burial site for so-called low-level and intermediate-level radioactive waste, not just from the Bruce Nuclear Power Plant, but from those 20 reactors across Ontario. And when you say intermediate-level waste, these are very euphemistic terms. These are the reactor internals, which have hazardous lives into the tens of thousands of years. And they want to put that less than a mile from the waters of Lake Huron. So we've got a real good battle on our hands. The Canadian nuclear establishment is as bad as or worse than the U.S. nuclear establishment.
And I see in Canada a number of the native people are opposing this as well.
Well, that's right. There are tribes very close to the Bruce Nuclear Power Plant. They've lived in its shadow and its radioactive emissions for decades at this point. And they're usually at the forefront of these battles against the Bruce. But in addition, and this is true in the United States, and it's really true across the world, there is a uranium mining boom on, supposedly. So there's a lot of prospecting going on. It's, you know, to fuel this nuclear relapse, supposedly. And up in Canada, in eastern Ontario, the native tribes have really, again, taken the lead in trying to stop this uranium mining from taking place on their lands. They had an occupation of their land against this uranium mining company that went on for a couple months until the Canadian courts threatened the leaders of the tribe with something like $7,000 a day in fines against them personally if the occupation continued. So they stopped the occupation, but there is a native grandmother. I don't remember how old she is, but she's elderly, and she's been on hunger strike for over 40 days, I think, at this point, against the uranium mining.
Let me bring up something I suspect. Maybe I'm wrong, but maybe it'll be something that's just nagging in the back of my mind. I've been an opponent of nuclear power, certainly nuclear armaments, forever, and I've worked with some of the people that you've mentioned in our bioregion here in the Great Lakes. But so there's somebody out there that's saying, hey, Kevin Camps, Peter Werbe, you guys are a couple of chicken littles. You know, you keep forecasting, predicting, you know, some doom. We're going to have these major accidents. There, you know, that there's spills, there's nothing. And really, all we can come up with is Three Mile Island, again, almost 30 years ago, and you know, over in Ukraine, where that was. And think about the management. Here we've got these modern plants, these managers, you know, Spence Abraham at the head of it. You know, we can do this. And in terms of the waste, hey, technology can solve everything. But take the first part, that... That everything you guys have predicted, there hasn't really been much.
Well, Davis Bessey, Ohio, just to the east of Toledo there, was the closest thing to a major accident in the United States since Three Mile Island. And folks may have caught some of the news in the local media there. The Toledo Blade was doing some pretty good coverage over the years. But in February of 2002, it was discovered that there was such a massive corrosion hole on the top of that reactor vessel that they were 3/16 of an inch, about the width of a pencil eraser. That's how much steel they had left. They had corroded through about 7 inches of steel at that point. And it's unclear how many days or weeks they had left before that hole was going to breach open. And if that had happened, they would have lost cooling. That would have been a loss of coolant accident. The water in the core would have turned to steam and escaped out that hole. There most likely would have been a meltdown. And if that meltdown melted through the foundations of the building, then you would have had catastrophic radioactivity releases into the Lake Huron watershed. And depending on which way the wind was blowing, that could have taken out Detroit. You know, it's another example. It's we almost lost Toledo.
But doesn't that make their argument? They would say that, yeah, right. Whew. But we caught it in time. We've got enough safety features in place that we can make sure that never happens.
Oh, the devil's in the details. Actually, the company wanted to keep running that plant for weeks longer. And it only took... it was a compromise with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who had already let them go for many months longer than they should have. You see, there was an emergency order across the country to do inspections to look for this very problem because it had been found in other reactors. And Davis Bessey kept saying, no, let us keep running. We've got a refueling outage coming up. If you make us go down, we're going to lose all this money. And the official report that came out of the NRC Office of Inspector General was that both the company and the NRC had put private profits over public safety. They had a very close call, and it was all because of their greed. And it was not because of safety regulations. It was the lack of safety regulations that led to that near disaster.
Let's. I'm just looking at our clock here. We have some minutes left that we can continue our conversation with Kevin Camps. He's the radioactive waste watchdog for Beyond Nuclear. You can go to beyondnuclear.org and find out a lot more information. In fact, I would highly suggest it because, you know, once these things are implanted, folks, it's pretty hard to uproot them. So these older plants that began in the 60s and 70s, they're already on their last legs. I think, what did they run for, Kevin, like 30 years or something?
Well, one would wish, but actually they get 40-year operating licenses.
Okay.
No reactor's ever made it that far yet, but they are now getting these 20-year license extension rubber stamps from the NRC. And the Cook Nuclear Plant in southwest Michigan has a 20-year extension. Palisades, incredibly, which has the most brittle reactor pressure vessel in the country, has gotten a 20-year license extension. It's not clear when Fermi 2 is going to go for its 20-year license extension, but it's an automatic rubber stamp. Try as we might to raise the safety issues at these plants, the NRC just grants these extra 20 years. So now we're talking 60 years of operations.
Yeah, it's frightening. Well, all right, so we don't want nukes. That's clear. And we see oil. I mean, when we talk about a war or an invasion and occupation of Iraq and the costs are coming up to $3.5 trillion, when we put gasoline in our tanks, we're probably really paying $15, $20 a gallon because that's all that tax money that came out of our pocket. So we need energy for an industrialized society. Is it there in alternative energy?
It absolutely is, and it's actually happening already. Wind power is the fastest growing new source of electricity, not just in the United States, but across the world. And even in Michigan, I've heard talk from the governor on down of 300 megawatts of new wind in Michigan. And that is right there a third of what the Fermi Nuclear Power Plant puts out. So there's tremendous potential for wind in Michigan. There's major advances in solar technology happening. Florida Power and Light, which happens to be a nuclear utility, announced that same weekend of that gathering in Warren, Michigan, that they're going to build two large-scale solar thermal concentrators, one in Florida, one in California. Each one is going to be 300 megawatts again. So you put those three renewable energy projects together, and you've got the Fermi Nuclear Power Plant. So it is happening already. Energy efficiency is the best way to go. It is seven times more cost-effective than nuclear power at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It just means we need to use our electricity more wisely and stop wasting it so much. Like Germany, which is phasing out nuclear power after this generation of nuclear power plants. They're not going to build any more. They're not granting any license extensions. They use half the electricity per capita that we do to enjoy pretty much the same standard of living as we do. So there's tremendous potential with efficiency and renewables, but what could happen if these federal loan guarantees for new reactors are enacted into law is that these new reactors are going to eat up all the money. There isn't going to be a penny left over for anything else, no matter how good an idea it is. And I have to say that Congressman Dingell, who's chairman of the Energy Committee in the U.S. House, has a huge role to play on this. He right now is trying to keep nuclear power plants eligible for these loan guarantees, and one has to wonder if it has anything to do with the new reactor proposed for his district. It's just a really bad idea. And I should mention that Congressman Upton from Southwest Michigan is probably the number one advocate for nuclear power in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's got both the Palisades and Cook nuclear plants in his district, three reactors there. And he tried and failed, fortunately, to secure 50% of all federal loan guarantees for energy just for new nuclear reactors. So we're talking about a figure of money. The nuclear industry is asking for $50 billion in these federal loan guarantees just in the next 2 years alone. So at $25 billion a year, you could really do a lot in terms of efficiency and renewables with that kind of money.
Sure. Certainly at the micro level, and we always hear about, you know, put in fluorescent bulbs and dial down and all that. And well, you should for one thing. It's you know, you'll save a lot of money. But it really has to be at the macro level, doesn't it? I mean, it has to be a social, societal decision of which way we're going. And so, I mean, at worst, a lot of these personal solutions, I don't mean to sound like Dick Cheney, but turn out to be just sort of marketing deals. You know what I mean? I mean, I try to do the best I can, but ultimately it has to be at the level of the entire society.
Well, there are societies that are doing it. I mentioned Germany, and they are emplacing a lot of wind power, a lot of solar power, and as I said, they're already very efficient. And that's why they are not only fulfilling their Kyoto obligations, but they're also phasing out nuclear power. And I should point to a country like Denmark, too, which is really the world leader on wind power. They get 25% or more of their electricity from wind power.
Kevin, let me interrupt you because I just noticed we got like 60 seconds left, and I forget what there's a phrase for it, but something or other that still we stop nuclear power tomorrow, which we should. Where's this waste going?
Nobody knows. There's no solution. The proposed Yucca Mountain dump site in Nevada is a disaster. If it goes forward, it's going to leak radioactivity massively into the environment. It would be a nuclear sacrifice area all the way downwind and downstream from there. We don't have a solution. There really is no solution in any country on the planet that has high-level radioactive waste. They talk a good line, but Yucca Mountain is really a doomed project. It should never open. And so the question is, where is the next dump site going to be located? Ironically, New Hampshire, another early primary state like Nevada, is at the top of the list for the eastern dump site.
Mm-hmm.
And have any of the mainstream media asked a single question to any of the presidential candidates who are in favor of nuclear power, where would you bury the waste? Because the Democrats are united, opposed to Yucca Mountain. Maybe that has something to do with the early primary in Nevada. But, you know, the next option on the DOE's hit list is New Hampshire, another primary state. So
Well,
politics of radioactive waste.
I began the show asking essentially what year is this, because in 1979 there was the big No Nukes concert with Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Browne, and Graham Nash. And maybe on Lisa, my end, I'll leave this with a slogan from that era, which was better active today than radioactive tomorrow. Kevin Camps, thanks for joining me. Kevin Camps is the radioactive waste watchdog for Beyond Nuclear. You can go to beyondnuclear.org. Thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks, Peter.
This is WRIN.com. WRIF for the New York Christmas Bash featuring Ashes of Soma.
Claus that same night, Ugly. Along with Mind Candy. Three great local bands on one stage on one night. Plus, don't miss a special appearance from the one and only.
Yolita, the Ghoul!
That's right, Santa Ghoul, live on location at New York, New York. It's the New York, New York Christmas Bash with the Riff this Saturday night at the all-new New York, New York, inside the Premier Entertainment Complex, 23 Mile Road in Chesterfield, just west of I-94, with 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. I can't count the number of times we've discussed the politics of the Middle East, the strife there, Iraq, and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, all the other aspects from foreign aid to oil, everything that's made that area of the world so contentious. And for some reason or other, the United States involved in it, 6,000 miles from home. We're told those are our interests over there. But we've probably last talked about this when our guest was Ali Abu Nima. He wrote a book called One Country, and I thought that had pretty much taken care of that aspect of it. Keep talking about a two-state solution. Ali Abu Nima said One Country. That's the name of his book. And when I came across another book that in many ways advocated the same thing, I thought, well, we had done that. But there's a lot more here, a lot more to discuss. The book is called Overcoming Zionism Towards a Truly Democratic Israel, which we'll get into what may seem like a contradiction to some of you. The author is Joel Covell, and Joel Covell has served as a professor in psychiatry, anthropology, political science, social studies, and communications. He's written 10 books, including this one, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism, or The End of the World. He's written books about racism, and he is currently the editor-in-chief of Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. We welcome Joel Covell to the Peter Werby Show. We reach him in upstate New York. Joel Covell, welcome to the program.
And greetings to you and
well,
to all the listeners.
I don't know really where to begin this. I'll tell you why we're doing this a second time, just other than its inherent challenging nature to sort of mainstream sensibilities or what everyone thinks is the best to settle problems there. But also your book, Overcoming Zionism Towards a Truly Democratic Israel, is the subject of attempted censorship.
Definitely, yeah.
No less by regents of the University of Michigan. Tell us what's going on here.
Well, it's you know, I want to boil it down. This is a bit of a narrative there, but essentially the book is published by Pluto, which is a British firm, but needs a distributor in the U.S. and is able to obtain the prestigious university press, the University of Michigan. And Pluto is a well-known progressive or left-wing publisher and is particularly known for publishing books critical of Israel and Zionism. And this is one of them. And it was doing all right, but in the middle of the summer, in August sometime, it was challenged by a group called Stand With Us Michigan, which is part of a larger movement called the Campus Watch Movement, which is a way of policing deviant thought that is deviating from the interest of Israel and the Zionist people here in the United States. And it was after a brief brouhaha was actually dropped temporarily by the University of Michigan Press, which was quite a big mistake that they made, if only because it was a breach of the contract. So they pulled it back in a little while and then began a examination, not so much of this book, but of the contract with Pluto Press, because the Zionist lobby was questioning why the University of Michigan should publish books by a press that put out such extreme stuff, and that as they saw it. A long struggle ensued, which was eventually won by the side of myself and Pluto Press and the committee that we organized, and we had a letter-writing campaign to sort of impress upon the University of Michigan Press and the administration of the university the necessity for preserving alternative voices, particularly in this momentous and racking struggle. As you pointed out earlier, there's really nothing in the world today that is more contentious, more controversial, more seemingly intractable, and therefore more in need of the widest range of opinions so that citizens can, you know, form their views.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fact. The fact of the matter is that in our society, there's a considerable constriction of opinion on this, and groups like Stand With Us Michigan and the so-called Zionist lobbies in general are, you know, part of the policing system there. So we had, you know, quite a contest which was resoundingly won by our side. Apparently, you know, some 650 letters in support of this book and a Pluto Press was sent into the university.
Yeah, I wrote one, actually, to the director, and
I
said, you censor, I censor. I don't do any more University of Michigan Press authors if you're going to censor Joel Covell's book.
Yeah, good for you.
Well, Joel Covell...
It made a big impression on them. It's a long story. There was a last gasp, or a hopefully last gasp, on the part of regents of the university to try to, you know, break down the contract with Pluto, but that seems to have been pushed back. And currently, you know, we're wiser, and I hope moving on to a better relationship.
Well, it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like these three University of Michigan regents are urging the university press to stop distributing books for independent from independent publishers. Now,
they don't care about the other publishers. They care a lot about Pluto.
Right. Your book, Overcoming Zionism Towards a Democratic Israel.
Yeah, actually, it's actually called Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. The copy you had has that other subtitle, which is not correct.
Boy, I don't even know if I can write that down.
That's okay. I'm sorry.
All right.
I wanted the viewers to know that this is the full subtitle.
Now, when one hears the word Zionism in a negative sense, it almost sends up a flag to many people, as the regents have said, as the book being anti-Semitic, that if you're anti-Zionist, that's almost code word, and it is to some extent among right-wing anti-Semitic forces of anti-Semitism, and Jewish Americans feel still that Jews are a threatened ethnic group, and to have this anything that even has a whiff of anti-Semitism is extraordinarily dangerous. Hence, they're very, very defensive about all this.
To say the least. Well, I can comment on that. Yes, there is. I am, first of all, of Jewish extraction, and I know the stories very well and went through this in my childhood. I was born in 1936, so I was 12. The State of Israel was formed and, you know, lived through the Second World War and the like. So I've been steeped in this, but the reality of anti-Semitism is profound, but what we see in these lobbies is to make use of that in order to enforce their own agenda. And it's very important that people be quite clear that there's no way that anti-Zionism is ipso facto, that is to say, in itself, anti-Semitic. Of course it can be, but you have to look at it each instance. So there's a very simple reason for this, is that by no means are all Jews Zionists. In fact, there's always been a very significant anti-Zionist tendency within Judaism itself, not just from people on the left like me, but from Orthodox Jews who feel that the State of Israel was a big mistake because it was put forth before the Messiah came, and, you know, there's quite a history there. And, you know, people like Gandhi, people like Tolstoy, or, you know, people like Einstein, for instance, who started out as a Zionist, became critical of Zionism as he grew older. You can't call Einstein anti-Semitic. He was always profoundly aware of his Jewishness and the like. And he felt, as I do, that the Zionism was a wrong turn in the history of Judaism. That's an arguable position. You know, it may be true, it may not be true. It has to be thought through. That's what my book tries to do.
Well, Joel Covell,
there's no way to say that's anti-Semitic.
Well, tell us, though, for people that that have heard the word a thousand times but aren't completely sure what Zionism is. Explain that and how you...
Well, it has a number of meanings, but there's one, I think, which sometimes is called political Zionism, because there's, you know, utopian Zionism and there's kinds of religious Zionism, but what we're talking about here is political Zionism, which is a movement of European, mostly Eastern European Jewish people who felt that the destiny of the Jewish people is to have a state, a nation state of their own in the lands of historical Palestine. And this is necessarily tied into biblical, you know, origins that the God, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, promised this in the Bible. It says so in the Bible. And this is the justification for this national home. So Zionism is the ideology, of the belief system, which holds that the destiny, if you like, of the Jewish people is to have this state, of which is now called Israel. That would be their homeland, their home base, and the like. And it is what is needed and proper and true for the Jewish people. And that's what I argue against in this book, and other people have argued against it as well.
Well, why would you argue against it? I mean, there's so many ethnic states, particularly in the Middle East. I mean, we wouldn't want that here. We don't. This is not a Christian nation, for instance. You wouldn't want. Usually we don't want that, but they certainly prevail all over the world.
Well, why don't we want it? Because it's wrong. I mean, it's always wrong to have a nation formed on ethnic grounds, because it privileges one group of people over the others, and although Israel proclaims itself as democratic, that's a very, very compromised form of democracy they have there, with a substantial mass of second, third, fourth class citizens, and that's a lot worse than that when you take up to the lands that have been conquered since 1967 and the like. What's wrong with it is manifold, but in this case, it's very elementary basis to it, is that the Jewish people didn't have an indigenous territory in which they were living. They came from Europe, and of course they came elsewhere, but the ones who founded Israel mostly, almost all came from Europe. And what they had to do in order to build their nation state was to conquer another territory. And not to just conquer the territory, but conquer the people, of course, who lived on it. And so it became just a hopelessly contradictory enterprise from the very beginning, because it was supposed to be for the emancipation of the Jewish people and their protection, but it was undertaken by the conquest and, you know, the domination and attempts to ethnically cleanse and even to annihilate the indigenous people. So it was built upon a very profoundly ethnocentric and even, I would argue, racist basis. So how can you have a worthwhile democracy for the great Jewish people who have had this fantastic history over 3,000 years with all of the, you know, magnificent accomplishments and the ethical principles, and you build a state for yourself, an Eastern Mediterranean state, which is predicated on ethnic cleansing and racism, and the racism which emerges from that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no doubt, if you do an honest history of Israel, as if people can just consult the works, for instance, of the Israeli historian Ilan, I-L-A-N, Pape, P-A-P-P-E, which is called, the most recent book is called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. There's absolutely no doubt that the basic narrative of the formation and maintenance of the Israeli state is the removal of the indigenous people. Now, of course, this is grimly reminiscent of what happened in the United States.
Well, let me interrupt you right there. I was going to say that white settler states, Europeans leaving their homeland for North America, Australia, South Africa, and the Middle East is not unusual. And we all now wring our hands about what the European invaders did to the indigenous people here. We say, well, you know, what are we going to do? All go back to Europe? It's that phrase that Zionist settlers often use, is that Israel is a fact on the ground.
Yeah, well, it's a fact on the ground, but so are the Palestinian peoples a fact on the ground. And nobody's talking about, at least I'm not talking about, the Israeli people having to go back to Europe. That's, you know, that's for them to decide, although it must be said that a lot of them have been leaving the country. Oddly, you know, ironically enough, to go to Germany more than any other place, which is, of course, the center of the Holocaust. And it's one of the deep ironies of modern history that this would be taking place. But in any case, it wasn't right when the Americans did it in this country. It certainly wasn't right for Australia to do it. It certainly wasn't right in South African case. Each of those had the history that you can unwind and unfold. In this instance, this is a history that has not yet been resolved, and it's I don't like to say this because it's too complex a statement, but I'll boil it down a little bit. I mean, basically, the U.S. arose because we could get away with the extermination of the natives. I mean, that's really bad, but the natives could be pushed back on the frontier. Israel, in a sense, tries to do the same, but it is a minority. It'll always be a minority state that is surrounded by hundreds of millions. I mean, it puts its flag right in the middle of the Arab world. You know, it can't, you know, it just can't clear out the natives, even as much as it tries. It tries to make life so miserable for them that they will give up and, you know, just leave on their own. But the Palestinians are hanging in there because they refuse to, do that. I mean, this is their human dignity. This is their homeland, too, and they're not going to be pushed out. So.
Mm-hmm. The book is Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine, and the working subtitle that I erroneously announced at the beginning of the show was Towards a Truly Democratic Israel.
Yeah. Now, that's fair enough.
But yeah, the Israeli fascist who was assassinated several years ago, Meir Kahane, once said that Israel can either be Jewish or democratic. And what he saw were the ethnographic pressures, of the demographic pressures, rather, or both, that would eventually make Jews a minority in a single state and could possibly be subjected to what they had been historically. He saw the necessity to promote Zionism as a way of self-protection to the for the Jewish people that it would be never again.
Right. Well, you know, it's understandable he would feel that way, and in a sense he was being more honest than, you know, the mainstream, but it doesn't make it right. I mean, you know, it's logically correct. It could be a Jewish state or a democratic state, let's put it that way. In other words, a Jewish state cannot be a truly democratic state, and if it's not a democratic state, and if it's surrounded by hostile forces, it's going to be a fascist state. It's going to be, which it is, a military, it's not fascist now, but it's a militaristic state. It's a state that is dominated by the use of force, dominated by organized violence, and becomes extremely corrupt. There's no end of internal corruption in the state of Israel because of this impossible position that it's in. So yeah, you can accept Kahane's duality, but you also can go beyond it. I mean, you can talk about, for instance, what happened in South Africa. Now, that's not exactly analogous, but it's pretty close. In fact, there's a lot of affinities between Israel and the Republic of South Africa in its apartheid era, and the apartheid state of South Africa was gradually brought down and overcome, to use the phrase in my word in my book, and a democratic state was built on its on its basis. When I say overcoming Zionism or ending the Jewish state, I had absolutely no intention of talking about driving Jews out, destroying what they have, and so on, but rather of developing a kind of, a higher form of society by very careful, painstaking process of nonviolent reconciliation between the peoples. And there are peoples on the other side who are willing to do this. It's going to be long, it's going to be slow, but it's much preferable to the current situation, which is simply one of doom.
Mm-hmm. Most Gentiles just see the struggle there between the two peoples as intra-Nicene, cousins in the way of Northern Ireland or the Balkans, and this is a conflict that goes way back, and they keep using the word intractable. That is, it's not really resolvable, because I was listening somewhere. I actually can't remember the source, but when someone passed over the idea that people like yourself, Joel Covell, and Ali Abu Nima put forth about a single single state as being right. absolutely improbable, that there is no way that the Israelis would ever agree to that, and it's very unlikely that even the Palestinians... I don't know.
I don't know, because you know, it's very complicated. But it's true. If you took a poll now, you'd get a minuscule support. But, I used to say the same thing. Oh, the Afrikaners would never accept a non-racist state. Well, 90% of them, 99% of them even have. It's amazing what people can adjust to.
Yeah, well, right now, as we speak and as this broadcast is being recorded, there's a meeting in Annapolis, and ostensibly to create a solution, another one of these peace conferences.
Right.
There's some thought, though, that that's not even really what's tops on the agenda, that more that it has more to do with a Middle East Sunni alliance with the United States against Iran.
It has a lot of texts. That certainly is one of them. It's an attempt on Condoleezza Rice's part to salvage some legitimacy from a ruined secretaryship of state. What it isn't is an honest effort to resolve the crisis in Israel-Palestine. I mean, it's a disgraceful farce. And
why? Tell
two levels.
I was going to say, tell us why. I think you were just
Two levels. I mean, the most important level is that the Palestinians aren't even represented there except by the stooge of a so-called president, Mahmoud Abbas, who's basically handpicked and supported by U.S. and Israel. And, they're marching with their feet. There's like hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Gaza and the West Bank. These are people living a very desperate life, and they're not about to tolerate this kind of abrogation of the most elementary principles of self-determination, which is that they should have a say in their fate. That they did have a say. There is a democratically elected government named Hamas. That is actually the true representative of the Palestinian people. I'm not thrilled with them, but they're by no means worse than the alternatives, and they are the democratically elected government that completely cut out of this. I mean, what kind of a peace process is that? So that's the most basic level. But even on the level, even if you so to speak assume that President Abbas is legitimate, which he most certainly is not, what he is asked to do is basically to perpetuate the same kind of apartheid situation. He's asked to engage in some kind of a charade with them. They'll try to work it out, but at the same time, they even ask the Palestinians to provide security for the Israeli forces. Israel has occupying Palestine, as you know, and it has the fourth largest army in the world, and they're asking Palestinians to provide their own security for it. I mean, there's no true motion, even within the farcical level of asking Abbas to represent the Palestinians, towards any kind of genuine political independence or sovereignty for the Palestinian people. If what they want as a two-state solution, that Israeli state and Palestinian state, what they're proposing is a two-state solution that is actually the kind of two-state solution that the South Africans have. But they have what's called Bantustan. What we don't have now in Israel, Palestine, is even the level of the apartheid Bantustan.
So you don't see much chance of success for this?
I have to say yes. That's correct. I don't see much. In fact, I don't see any chance of success. I think it's negligible. Now, maybe something will come from the blue and turn this around. It would require a phenomenal, astounding about face on the part of U.S. and Israel. So, maybe they're going to do it. Maybe George W. Bush will see the light and actually work towards genuine sovereignty for the Palestinians. That's
where can it go?
It's logically possible. It's just I don't see any empirical hope.
Got about 60 seconds. Where can it all go in the real world?
Well, I hope it doesn't go downhill further. I hope that people all around the world join hands and recognize that the so-called two-state solution is bankrupt now. The Israelis have actually destroyed the premise of it, and that the only alternatives are either this horrible status quo, which is just leading towards endless war and annihilation of the whole people, or to try to painfully but creatively build a genuine alternative, which is a state that is for all of its citizens and not just for Jews only as the power structure. So in other words, it's to think in terms of a society that would provide, I think, genuine security, which is but at the price, which I think is a very worthwhile price, of giving up the idea of a Jewish state. I don't think the Jewish state has served the Jews very well. I think it's been terrible for the Jewish people. I argue that in my book. Other people argue it too. It's a worthwhile argument. It's certainly not an anti-Semitic argument, and it's one that I think people are going to have to start confronting as they survey the ruins of the peace process, the roadmap, and the imperial and colonial arrangements that are being worked out in that part of the world.
Well, thank you so much. The book is Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. The author is Joel Covell. It's published by Pluto Books. It's distributed in the U.S. by our own University of Michigan Press. Let's make sure that they keep on doing that.
That's right.
And, Joel, I asked you if there was a good website, and I was just, while we were talking, I brought up joelcovell.org. Isn't that a decent one to send people to?
Well, that's a decent website. I have some more about my other books than about this one, but there's that, yeah.
Okay, so that's Joel Covell. I'll also have a link on my website, peterwerbe.com. That's Werbe. Joel Covell, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Peter.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
wouldn't it be grand to gather around and have a listen?
Well, turn something on. I'm starting to think.